covered by federal graduate medical education payments. The state of Wyoming does not benefit from the federal leg of that stool. We opted out in the 1970s. Under the Sullivan and Geringer administrations, the state of Wyoming tried to get back in. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services indicated that we cannot get in. This federal legislation, if successful, which is questionable, would give us a foot in the door to be treated like other states.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, let me add to that. At this point in time, the two programs, the Family Practice Center in Cheyenne and the one in Casper in combination, make UW the largest provider of health care to the uninsured and underinsured in the state. I would expect that we would see the number of visits continue to increase. The last time we saw a noticeable increase really was 2008, 2009 with the downturn of the economy. Folks who lose insurance or are unable to continue to make their payments, this is their safety net. I don't think anyone would stand or sit in front of you and suggest that medical costs are going to decrease.
Mr. Chairman, as far as the docs who are training there, how many of those are WAMI students? It's not that high a percentage, are there?
Mr. Chairman, the percentage that are WAMI students, very small. I believe we just recently have had either our first or our first couple of students from the WAMI program. Although our retention in the state from the residents select is it high 40s? About 45% of the residents in the two programs after their three-year residency remain in Wyoming, according to our records, and practice medicine. There are approximately 48 residents at any point in time, so we're cycling through about 16 a year. So I'm going to say ballpark, that's about 8 new physicians a year, every year that program is contributing to the state.
So there's 45 in the state, and they're in different groups of kind of a third, a third, a third, basically, is what you're – so about 8 new docs a year then.
We have 48 and 12 attending physicians, 12 senior physicians supervising 48 residents. About two-thirds of the residents are in Casper, and one-third of the residents are in Cheyenne.
How many, just so we can kind of get a figure, so if we're – maybe producing for the state 8 docs, you know. This is outside the medical care issue. How many of our WAMI students are really, how many are we producing now a year that actually come back to Wyoming to take advantage of the loan repayment?
We have about, at this point, we have about 16 per year that are graduating. Those numbers will gradually climb to 20. And about 2 out of every 3 of those students return to practice medicine in Wyoming for at least 3 years.
So right now about 12 out of the 16.
So it's
about, did you say two-thirds or three-quarters?
About two-thirds.
Okay, so a little less. So, so we're going to get plus 10 out of WAMI a year, and that might jump up to as many even as, 13, so around 10 or so. Okay. All right, thank you.
Like, to follow up on that that conversation, my guess is that the WAMI is sending a higher proportion of specialists back, and the family practice, whatever you're retaining there, are going to be family practice doctors, primary care.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
What did you say was the retention rate for an annual? How many docs are coming back?
From WAMI?
No, from the family practice.
From the family practice, it's about almost 50% of 3 years, 48, so 16, about 8. I'm going to say
that
with eight, fluctuations in there.
8 per year?
Yeah.
That can stay. And I guess part of the importance there is you've got physicians that are in family practice that are staying with whatever caseloads, incomes that are afforded by Wyoming, whereas the specialists get a whole different picture coming off the WAMI program. Okay, any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, President, I was just kind of going through the list of employees as you list them with the salary and benefits, and a couple of things struck me. Your PAMP positions on the first page, the fourth position, those two. So I assume you're going to either try to recruit. Or do you have people in mind? Are they coming from the other place? Are you going to try to recruit a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner? And the salary range, where did you get that amount? I'm just curious of how you determined those salary ranges.
For the Casper Residency Center, when the CHCCW and UW went our separate ways, the employees really were attached to both organizations, and a significant number of them opted to move with UW. They would have brought their salary with them. So I think that was an existing salary under the old arrangement and simply transferred it from a set of books that was being kept by someone else to UW.
Thank you.
I wanted to make a little bit, I mean, I know that it's already happened, but going back to this so-called divorce, we've got funding going into both entities. So we fund the community health centers and we fund you. And yet we find out that there's a divorce happening where there's no opportunity for any sort of legislative involvement. Can you explain a little bit about the divorce, what happened, why it happened, and why it couldn't be mediated, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, I'll give you a brief explanation. The arrangement that produced the combined UW effort with the Community Health Center of Central Wyoming is more than a decade old. It was created really based on a report commissioned by the university more than a decade ago that was looking for mechanisms by which we could tap Medicaid Part 2 payments from the federal government to increase clinic revenues in a way to make those programs more self-sustaining. The way in which that played out was to create a community health center and for UW to slide in, if you will, underneath the umbrella of that community health center and to continue to deliver both graduate medical education and medical services. One of the requirements established by the federal government for the operation of the community health center is that more than 50% of the members of the governing board have to be patients of that clinic. I would suggest to you that what happened in the intervening years was that the governing board of the community health center was comprised most frequently of lay folks who had little, may have had interest, but had little expertise or involvement in any kind of medical program delivery. And it was a significant struggle, I'm going to say, to keep the programs up and operational with a governing board that turned over CEOs on a pretty regular basis with whom we had significant accounting and financial disagreements. That was brought to a head here this past year after 8 or 9 years of talking about options and alternatives. It came to a head when the CHCCW decided that it would move much of its practice in the direction of those medical procedures, I think, that offered relatively positive returns on performance. And our concern always had been a diversity, exposing our residents to a diversity of medical conditions and a built-in inefficiency that came with our operation as a result of having both an attending and a resident physician involved in many exams. So we were not as cost-effective as we might have been by design. And we had an increasingly cost-sensitive organization with the CHCCW I would add to that, and we also had, on both sides, we had difficult personalities to help make that situation worse than it even was. That resulted in the decision to separate, with the CHCCW moving to a different location but taking the equipment with them, and we stepped in. Well, we didn't step in. We were already in a building that we had owned for many years. We purchased some additional equipment that we needed to stay operational, and never did have to close our doors, although I think there certainly was a little bit of disruption in Casper for a little while.
Well, I guess in the end of the day, we have now two facilities, both paid by taxpayers, or is the other the CCH taxpayer? Pardon?
We have three operations. We have the operation in Casper, which we run.
I'm just talking about from the divorce.
Is the CHCCW still operating? I think so, but we've not had any work with them since the summertime. We maintain three programs, Cheyenne, Casper, and a satellite operation that's operated a couple days a week by the Cheyenne physicians in Pine Bluffs, and that's been the Pine Bluffs satellite operation's been in place now probably for close to a decade.
I assume though the community health position, same ones that Senator Hastert was talking about the other day with respect to whether or not that's same dollar, same fund, does it not? On the are they different?
Mr. Chairman, we can check that information for you and get back to you, but I believe the CHCCW is a federally funded program.
No state funding at all.
I don't believe so.
No state money. Mr. Chairman, you did pass a bill last year, I believe, that provided $2 million in a competitive grant for CHCCWs. No, any community health center, not just the one in Casper.
You got part of that grant, or would you?
I do not know, but another component of this is they were successful in securing a $10 million federal ARRA grant and are in the process of building a facility in East Casper.
I guess that's my point. So now the divorce yields two facilities paid for by taxpayers of some sort, and now you have two facilities to maintain. And ultimately, we pay for it. I suppose that some you either be competitors or you serve different populations. But I guess my frustration is that we sent out two entities paid for by federal state funds with two sets of chiefs on it. When they can't get along, they break up. And we pay the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe the state supports the CHCCW.
Frankly, if it's federal dollars or state dollars, we're still paying the tax dollars. I mean, it comes out of our pockets. Everybody in this room still pays federal tax, income taxes. And so,
Mr. Chair, just to explore that a little bit, and I think you said it earlier, Don, that I just want to make sure I was clear. So these two facilities might very well are serving different folks. It sounds like the community health center is wanting to go into the more profitable, especially pursuing some of those patients and really jettisoning some of the ones really that UW is serving. Is that – did I hear that right, or is that
– Mr. Chairman, Representative Harshman, there are some different populations, but undoubtedly there is also competition.
Okay.
And I should also mention that there is a community health center here in Cheyenne as well, which has never been affiliated with the Family Practice Residency Center. So in this community, we have essentially the same situation that you have currently in Casper.
Find out for us, just let us know what, and maybe our staff does, to figure out what resources, if any, that we provide other than a $2 million competitive grant to the community health centers. I'd like to know that. Now, So the divorce has occurred, and I think your point there is that, look, if you look at the total commitment we're making to the Casper facility and the Cheyenne facility, they're about the same now, within $1 million.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And so then the next issue is, where do you go from here? And you outlined the three potential reconfigurations to attract other resources to operate this. Now, is this a task that essentially falls back to you as the UW to do it, or is there a legislative committee overseeing this? Are you guys sort of out there alone on this?
Mr. Chairman, to this point, we are pursuing this independently.
All right. So how do we, given that we're doing the funding, how do we go about making sure that what you're doing is something that the legislature approves of and agrees to? I can go with some ideas, but have you guys given it consideration?
Mr. Chairman, I think an appropriate approach might be to use some of the language in the governor's recommendation, charge the University of Wyoming to report back on perhaps a series of options. The ones I provided to you today are just those that have been identified immediately. We have secured, independent of the governor's recommendation, an external expert to review these things and to present. Some of these are not optimal choices, but to present the array of options to either your committee or the Joint Health, Labor, and Social Services Committee.
And my assessment of it is that both communities, Cheyenne and Casper, want these facilities there. The communities make a continuous statement that it's needed. It provides an area of your health care, and the costs are expensive and they're going up. So what I'm wondering is whether or not we ought to add this to the list of interim studies and or a footnote. Representative Edmonds.
Mr. Chairman, what I would say, though, the community health centers versus the residency program do have, I think, very different needs. And community health centers, depending on what the Supreme Court decides with the federal health care legislation, they will either come into play in a huge way, in a way they never have before in the landscape, and would pretty much render this discussion mute. I mean, it would not make any difference. So I don't know that we want to necessarily study it because we don't know what's going to happen federally.
Well, let me retreat a little bit. The divorce has happened. It's gone. And it sounds to me like the community health centers are going to be, if they're federally aligned or paid, they're off doing what they're going to do. But with respect to the residency centers and trying to reevaluate their costs, how much commitment, how much growth to expect, I mean, is the committee okay with just saying, UW, you've got three options, continue to search for it, and it becomes a university function to determine how these institutions are going to be funded, which of the three options, if any, that they perceive or they come across, or do we want to take a look at these things? They're getting more expensive every year, and ultimately it's the Cheyenne Casper folks that really defend them, and that's great. But UW is it's kind of an unusual situation because we don't have a medical school. Well, we do have the WAMI program. It's really not a medical school, but it's being operated as a teaching facility, I guess. Is it a comfortable relationship?
The WAMI relationship?
Well, your oversight of the residency centers.
It is now.
Because we pulled out of your block grant.
Because I think in part for that reason, but in part because of the changes that occurred in Casper. Both of these programs are today, I'm going to say, running the way we would hope they would and getting stronger.
What kind of, if we go back and project the increases in budget requests, what's What kind of increases would we be adding in on an annual basis? Has it been a 10% increase?
Mr. Chairman, volume is not a problem in terms of volume of patients.
But
pain patients is a significant problem. It's not as noticeable in the Casper situation, but it will be. With the Cheyenne situation on page 23, it becomes more noticeable. The legislature appropriated $1.6 million for last biennium, essentially $800,000 a year. In this biennial's governor's rec, he recommends $2.3 million. He also puts the same proviso on there that we look to identify how to reduce our reliance on state general funds. In addition to reorganizations, there are other options. We could have reduced services. We could have reduced faculty. We could have reduced number of residents. That also comes with not only educational consequences, but healthcare delivery consequences in the community served.
And my question, really back to the you folks, do you want all these decisions made in Old Main, or do you guys want to, do the communities want to have a piece of this, and how do you get involved?
Mr. Chairman, I was reminded of Director Forslund's testimony yesterday where he's outlining his how he's going to approach these program performance evaluations, and I just pulled that out, and I think this program is probably ripe for a good analysis like that. What are our baselines? What's our objectives? Where are we headed? And of course, with the money component as well, I think we could. I'm agreeing that we do need to analyze this.
Mr. Chairman, we did have. We've not had a management audit. We did have an external review of the Cheyenne program within the last 9 months. So we do we have a start to that. I don't think the Casper program has not been reviewed in a number of years.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Just on page 13 there at the bottom, the narrative, and I just highlighted a couple of these patient encounters. Is that what you call a patient visit? You're estimating then 57,500 patient visits per biennium. Or is that in Casper? Is that, and then another Cheyenne generates 60,000 patient visits. Is that what you're? So combined, there's about nearly 120,000 patient visits at these two. Is that just so I'm reading that right? And then I look up and we're paying about $10.5 million as the budget for WAMI to produce about 10 docs, so about $1 million apiece, really. And then our $30 million in this budget, if we approve this, is really producing 8 docs for the state and 120,000 doctor visits. And so at some point we're going to have to figure out, is that the best way or is there another way? And so, Mr. Chairman, you're asking the question. I think it's something we take a look at. I mean, we've got our two population centers of the state. It's a huge issue. And, boy, if you were to shut these down in Cheyenne or Casper, I just, you know, they're going to go to emergency rooms. You're going to have emergency rooms. And then that's another part of the budget we're going to deal with. So I think it's worth our committee taking a look at. So that's my 2 cents.
Well, I don't know whether we're the right committee or it's labor, but I think if we put in our – we put on our list, we'll find out. Is there anything else?
Mr. Chairman, there'd be nothing wrong with going into learning more about this anyway and figure out better ways of doing it.
So do I see a consensus then? We'll put it on the interim study list, and then management council can decide whether and if to sign it out. Okay, we'll do that. And then, in the meantime, you've got your outside consultant. You're going to pursue these three remedies, and I guess would it be your practice to report that report out to labor, or do you just keep it in Old Main? And
Mr. Chairman, we'd be pleased to report it out.
Would you do that?
Yes.
To us as well, would you? Thank you. give it to labor and us, then we'll see what it is. Now, that study, is it going to be applicable to both facilities or just the Casper facility?
Mr. Chairman, it would be applicable to both, but not necessarily. One doesn't necessitate the other.
Fair enough. All right, any more questions on the Casper residency program? And I take it now with respect to the other question is so you've got the exception request, and in effect, does this fund the B-11 that's already been approved so that you have to have this money, or you got to undo the B-11? Well, you can't undo the B-11. That bell's been rung, I guess. And so as we're looking through this budget, I'm guessing your position is we have to fund these. A lot of them are internal funds, but you need to have these dollars to operate the system.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Next budget? Casper, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, the next budget is the identical scenario in Cheyenne. We have the same exception request relative to compensation on page 23. That explanation relative to Casper applies here to Cheyenne. And then we have an exception request on page 25. We did not have a divorce in Cheyenne, but it has fiscal challenges of its own. In the summer of 2008, there was a B-11 approved by the by Governor Friedenthal to expand the services offered in Cheyenne. That B-11 included overly optimistic clinic revenue that has never been attained. UW has, however, taken a number of successful steps to improve both revenue and expenditure side. For example, we have reduced Cheyenne faculty by two positions. We've increased the Cheyenne revenue by 20%. We've successfully addressed a serious Medicare billing issue, identified a number of other vehicles to enhance income, address critical accreditation issues after becoming an independent entity in the Casper situation. And we're currently engaged in a national search for a new program director both in Casper and Cheyenne. Nonetheless, the cumulative impact of these efforts has not aligned total revenues with total expenses. Last year, the legislature appropriated $1.6 million. We are seeking to continue that funding, and Governor Meade recommended $2.3 million in one-time general funds with the same requirement as he imposed on Casper, that is, to provide a report to reduce the reliance on general funds. Again, there are some significant policy issues at play that come along with the implications on the educational mission as well as the health care in Southeast Wyoming.
Well, maybe this discussion is for both these institutions, and that is, the idea of making $2.3 million general fund for operating dollars that are one time seems a little bit, unless there's some notion that you're going to be able to replace that revenue, but if you're going to use it to pay your operating costs, what could you do to wean yourselves of that fund?
Mr. Chairman, we could gradually scale down on the scope or the volume of the operation.
Well, and that's exactly my point. If you're going to, if the notion is it's one time and you're never going to get back, that's one message. If the notion is it's one time and we'll readdress it, that's a different issue. One means you begin to cut your budget, and the other means you begin to look at other sources of revenue, and you come back and says, hey, we tried. Now you're going to have to fill the hole, if you will, with general funds. Do you know which message is being sent?
Mr. Chairman, I think that is the motivation for the study that we're discussing, is to lay those options out, make a decision, and move forward so we do know.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. President Buchanan, if we cut those services, am I correct in that then those individuals would most probably end up again in our emergency room or in some other facility where the services would still not be paid for?
I would assume so.
Okay. And then the second question I have for you is, if we eliminated the residency program, what happens with the UW Medical Partnership What are your choices there? You're not operating that.
Madam Chairman, if I don't know, I think it's possible but uncommon for an entity other than a university to operate a graduate medical education program. So I think were that to happen, it would be likely that we would stop with the residency program and would have to make a decision about whether or not the state wanted to support free clinics of some sort in communities in Wyoming.
I just wanted to have that coordinated.
With respect to the salary request, before we leave, I do want to say that if we go back to the discussion of why are we increasing your budget only to ask for cuts, do these salary increases go with whatever decisions that we make with UW? If we decide not to give UW salary increases, would the same analysis apply to these salaries, or is there something special about these institutions that would deserve salary increases?
I think they ought to be treated consistent with UW,
okay.
Mr. Chairman.
That's helpful. Then with respect to the I'm still struggling with one-time general funds, and ultimately you're saying is, hey, we have a shortfall, and we've got to make it up, but here's my problem. We go back to this notion that if we end up looking at budget cuts, we're giving you one-time money and then asking you to cut back. I think I need a little more explanation as why you need money in this program that would be so important that we wouldn't just flatline you and say, look, live with what you have.
Mr. Chairman, without that infusion of one-time money, we will begin to draw back on the scope and volume of services that we provide. We'll live within our means, whatever that budget will support. We know for this coming year that without that supplemental support, we will need to cut back services, and we can do that.
Fair enough. But that suggests to me that for the Cheyenne facility, you ran it at a deficit last year, did you?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And how much did you funnel in? Where did the money come from, and how much did you funnel into it?
Mr. Chairman, essentially the legislature provided sufficient funding last year to cover our deficit of $1.6 million, $800,000 a year. And we are living within the means allocated in the current biennial budget. So we don't actually have a shortfall.
And that money that we gave to you was given on a one-time basis?
Mr. Chairman, that was.
So this, in a sense, you're saying this biennializes that one-time payment?
It continues, and in fact, it increases the one-time amount. So it essentially
well,
is
sound like a continuation.
Yeah.
It sounds like an increase.
Yeah, it's recurring and higher.
Why? Reoccurring, I understand. Why higher?
I think a couple of issues respond to the why higher question. Part of it has to do with the development of the standard budget where equipment was not included in the standard budget, so we had to ask for that again. And I'm searching for the page that articulates that. On page 24 of the budget, there's $705,000 in the clinic revenue shift, the $1.6 million, and then a small amount for replacement and outdated equipment, which was not folded into our standard budget.
Well, I guess if we take a step back, what you're really asking for between these two programs is about a 10% increase of general fund. Is that a...
Mr. Chairman, on the CASPER, we're asking for no increase. It's essentially...
Well, I put them together and blended them.
Oh.
So you blend them together, you're about a 10% increase. Is that about right?
1.4, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, that's close.
And I guess the question then is, in the absence of coming up with a plan, are you going to be expecting 10% increases every year to run this program? And if so, we have to decide whether we can afford that or whether we've got to have a structural change.
Mr. Chairman, I think realistically, in the absence of cutting back services or reorganizing under one of the three alternatives, I think the cost increases are likely to be continued at that rate, or some direction from policymakers that the functions ought to live within their means, which will mean reduced services.
That's the answer I was looking for. So that what means that we either say do the study and we'll worry about this next year, or we begin to take closer oversight now. And I guess what I'd kind of like to do is we put it on our list. What you're telling us, I think, is that if we don't give you this request, accepting the salary part, so you pull the salary part out, the balance of it, if you don't get it, you'll have to begin immediately cutting back services.
Mr. Chairman, cutting back staff, which would translate into services.
That's the way I would see it. So that's the message we'll take to markup. And then, Don, I think kind of if you can do it, or I know you can do it, and this doesn't have to come immediately, but I think I'd like from you between now and as soon as you can get it out is some sort of a paper just talking about what the increases have looked like if you look back, what you see going forward, and maybe recapitalize some of the options you have and sort of give us a blueprint going forward of the things that need to be decided to kind of decide budgetary-wise what we're going to do. Is that okay?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Also, I think we all assume what the services are that are being provided by the staff that you currently have employed, but I think that's important for us to get a more holistic picture of the community and what services are being demanded.
Madam Chair, we can do that.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, the WAMI discussion begins on page 31. We have a much smaller but identical issue again relative to compensation, $60,771, which the governor denied. Again, this is to keep folks who are teaching side-by-side other faculty in the College of Health Sciences on parity. So what you do with the 067 compensation discussion is relevant here in our view. The second request has four parts, but none of these should be a surprise. Last year, the legislature imposed a footnote number 2 to the 167 budget, which directed us to expand the program from 16 to 20 students. We did so. At that time, we indicated that the legislature could expect increases in four areas. Number one, through a recontract with WAMI. We were the only state since the 1990s that has not been paying summer tuition for our students. They have imposed that now as a condition of the expansion of the class. That comes in, I believe, at about $7,000 a year. There is a tuition factor from the University of Washington for both FY13 and 14 at 3%. That's the second component. The third component is the actual expansion from 16 to 20 students. So we have four more students for which we will be paying tuition. Of course, the following year it's 8 more students. The year after that it's 12 more students. The year after that it's 16, and then it levels off. So we will have a total of 80 medical students in the pipeline. The last item relates to request for support costs and a part-time faculty member. When we presented this budget last time, we asked only for the support costs. I suspect you may have recalled the conversation we had about buying an extra cadaver for the four additional students. We, in our budget request, also asked for a half-time or a part-time faculty member. The governor denied both the supplies and the part-time employee. He agreed with everything else. Yes, he denied that.
Mr. Chairman, we do need it.
That's enough. If there was a block grant, we'd say, hey, you're going to have to go get it. Yeah. I assume that the...
Mr. Chairman, if we were operating our block grant, we could probably find a cadaver.
Yeah, the... I was going to go there, but I didn't think it was going to be as funny if I said it. The... all right, so I guess my... In this one, with respect to the cadaver, when we say no and you need a cadaver, what do? Do you go into your block grant and produce a cadaver?
Or, Mr. Chairman, that's as good an explanation as I'm going to come up with.
Okay, that's fine. That's the, now, have we had any, how's it been going with respect to producing the additional four students? Have we produced 20 qualified students?
Mr. Chairman, the pipeline of qualified students that we now have that interview for WAMI slots is well-populated and solid. There was a time not too long ago when we had concerns about the ability to maintain an adequate volume. That's no longer the case. I think that's a credit to the efforts of the part of the College of Health Sciences.
Good. Any other questions on the WAMI? And we'll be seeing these corresponding increases for the next until all those positions are populated at all levels. All right. Any further questions on WAMI? Next item.
Mr. Chairman, the next item is the advanced practice nursing in psychiatry. We do not have a exception request, but I think some program changes warrant a very brief discussion. This is a loan for service program that extends to 12 students per biennium for UW's advanced nurse practitioner program. That previously was a master's degree program. The Board of Trustees approved a change to that in May of 2010, I believe, to become the Doctor of Nurse Practitioner program, which changes it to a three-year program. It previously has had great success. There have been 30 students since 2007 who have received loans. 13 of them have completed, as well as completed their payback or are doing so. Six additional folks will graduate this spring, and six are in repayment or have fully paid. Three are in a grace period, one is in collection, and one is in forgiven due to hardship. The nurse practitioner program has two tracks, family practice and psychiatry. This program only applies to the psychiatry position. The standard budget request is sufficient for the next biennium, but I think it's worth a review, probably not by this committee, but by the Joint Labor Committee, because the requirements of the program are changing from 2 years of academic study to 3 years of academic study. It may be worth extending the payback period for these funds. I will also be candid that we are having difficulty attracting new students into this scholarship program. We have one so far for next fiscal year, and we'll be actively recruiting in the spring to fill those slots.
Labor talk to them about putting that on their agenda.
Mr. Chairman, if not on their agenda, I know that Senator Schiffer is quite involved in tracking the progress on this program.
Good. Other questions? If not, next item.
We have two more, Mr. Chairman. YDENT program on page 40 of your budget. This program was cut back from 10 students per year to 8 in 2009 due to the budget reductions. The exception request before you is to comply with 5% tuition increases per year, fiscal year 13 and 14, at both universities, University of Creighton and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. If you elect not to approve the increase, it simply means that we will have funds to provide slots to approximately 7 students rather than 8.
Are you having any difficulty filling these slots?
Mr. Chairman, not so far.
Questions? We're in the last budget.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, on the brand budget for nursing on page 44, again, we have no exception requests. We provide 5 loans up to $25,000. These, again, are loans for service. The students repay that if they choose to work outside of Wyoming. They pay it in cash. If they work inside, they can work it off.
All right. Any other questions on this budget? I think that takes us back to the 67 on the...
distance education?
Distance education. How's everything going?
It's going well, sir. Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Chair, thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today about the distance education, distance learning, and video conferencing task force that we were assigned via the governor's office. My partner here, Dr. Maggie Murdoch, and I am, of course, Dr. Carla Leach from Western Wyoming Community College, and Maggie from the University of Wyoming. We appreciate the committee's allowing us to visit with you today. We wanted to remind you maybe just very, very briefly about the history of this particular fund and the effort associated with it. We were assigned on this task force, I believe, in 2008, and we specifically, this task force was put together as to develop a collaborative concept without creating another silo for reducing duplication of requests of equipment for video conferencing and for distance learning, and to also improve distance learning so that it could be more broadly accessible across the state. We have spent a great deal of time working on this, meeting sometimes every other week, often once a month, trying to make sure that we're making good decisions on how to do this. I think that we may have blazed some trails, but we've actually moved forward on this endeavor, learning a great deal about what it's like to try to combine the efforts of many agencies with the educational institutions in the state. We bumped our heads into political walls. It took a great deal of talk in the first year and a half in order to navigate those waters. But we have moved forward. Once again, we're working to reduce duplicated equipment and staff, and also identifying how to do this right. If we are indeed going to expand distance learning in the state throughout the agencies, and if we're going to have a centralized help desk, we need to make sure we do it right. If we don't, we will have spent a lot of effort, time, and money, and no one will use it. Therefore, we will have failed. So we understand the very important reasons that we need to address these issues very, very carefully. We have actually accomplished a good bit in the last 2 years. We have brought together all the stakeholders, and those stakeholders include the participation of the K-12 schools, the Wyoming Department of Education, community colleges, Community College Commission, University of Wyoming, the State Library, multiple state agencies, and multiple state organizations. We brought them together in visioning sessions for both distance learning and video conferencing. We had very robust conversations and have developed a vision statement for both video conferencing and for distance learning, to identify the needs, the holes, what we need to address, and what we might be able to do better. So with that, I will pass this off to Dr. Murdoch.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to introduce Dr. Liz Simpson, who's sitting in the audience here. She is the director of the Wyoming Distance Learning Center. We were going to have Robert Aylward from UW, who was one of the co-chairs of this task force. He chose to go to the dentist this afternoon instead of being here, so he sends his regrets. We also have a member of our task force here, and that's Andy Corbin from the Wyoming Community College Commission. A few things that we'd like to point out with regard to the accomplishments we think are things that are pretty unique that has happened. So first, with the Wyoming Distance Learning Center, it's really the first effort to develop a statewide educational institutional, state agency, and professional organization distance learning collaborative. Reduces duplication and overlap overcomes the gaps in the availability of distance learning of all kinds and at all levels. It's also the first effort to move state agency training into a distance format on a common platform to reduce travel, time away from the office, and the costs associated with both travel and with training. Some of the first courses will go live, I think, in February. And one of those, one agency will be the Wyoming Law Enforcement Academy, and another one will be Workforce Services. It's also the first effort to develop a shared statewide clearinghouse of information and training about best practices and new technologies for all Wyoming distance learning providers and learners that enhances expertise statewide and reduces the cost of duplicative efforts. Fourth, it's the first effort to provide a statewide resource for the development of quality online instruction. So in state agencies, community colleges, the university, and professional organizations. It's also the first effort to develop a baseline database of provider and learner knowledge of attitudes toward and expectations for distance learning in Wyoming. That baseline data will serve as the basis for our assessment concerning the effectiveness of the Distance Learning Center. Significance of the accomplishments of the Video Conferencing Enterprise, or the VCE. It represents the full cooperative integration of completely separate and disparate systems and departments and signifies the intent of a path forward for a more transparent and efficient statewide platform for video conferencing. Right now, the three main statewide video conferencing systems, that is the Wyoming Video Conference System, which is the state system, the WIN Video, which is part of the Wyoming Department of Education, and the Outreach Video Network, which is part of the university, have all been technologically integrated. The job of the Video Conference Enterprise is to provide centralized services in three main areas. One is bridging. So all those, I think there's about 400 endpoints across the state, can be reached through one bridging complex. Another one is scheduling, so that scheduling can be done centrally rather than everybody having their own, which I've found out, very expensive centralized programs. And a third, and most importantly, I think, and Dr. Leach has pointed this out, a help desk that provides help for end users. This is particularly important for instruction, K-12, community college, and the university. Something different from a net desk where somebody takes a trouble ticket and says, we'll get back to you, perhaps somebody who follows through so the class does not, in fact, get canceled for the night. Second thing, accomplishment of the video conference system is that it provides new possibilities. It includes the recent purchase of a new high-definition capable core bridging infrastructure. And all of the, we sent you other accomplishments of the VCE. So, to the budget, and I'm unsure exactly about all the information that Don included in the packet that he sent you. I believe that there is a revised budget in information, but to start with what the governor originally proposed, and that is that we would request $2.67 million for the Wyoming Distance Learning Center for the video conference. Enterprise, we requested $2.94 million. The governor recommended no additional funding for the next biennium for either of these entities, rather saying that we could roll over the funds that we have. We will have some rollover funds, and we will have those rollover funds, and I think Carla and I and maybe other members of the task force would be the first to say, we came here 2 years ago asking you to fund an idea, and you did fund an idea. And now we have some operating entities that are, in fact, bringing disparate parts of the state together and saving duplicative costs and also saving time and providing good training and good learning and good robust video conferencing enterprises, distance learning and video conferencing, both as strategic assets for the state. So you funded us. We will have some rollover. We came with an idea, and we're building those entities. They are still fledgling entities. We did our best 2 years ago to tell you what funds that we needed, and you did appropriate those funds. We've tried to spend those funds in a reasonable way, but we will have some rollover. As I said, the governor did not propose any additional funding. We have provided you with two different budget revisions. One is a maintenance-only budget, and that would be for the Distance Learning Center an additional $807,000. For the Video Conference Enterprise, $1.9 million. I can tell you that for a maintenance-only budget, what you see right now is about what you're going to get. We will maintain what we are able to do. We will not be able to expand the kind of capabilities that we have in help desk, with bridging, and with scheduling. The Distance Learning Center will not be able to serve a lot more clients. So we're doing well. They have been, I think, two entities that have been more successful than anybody on this task force could have expected them to be. But with that maintenance budget, a total of $2.7 million, as opposed to nothing that was recommended for the governor. Included with your materials should be the reauthorization letter from Governor Mead to the task force. And we see that as a visionary charge. And in fact, asking us to do more things than what we were charged with doing in 2008. In order to accomplish those things, in order to continue to collaborate across state agencies and institutions and organizations, we're going to have to do this right, as Dr. Leach said. So to meet the reauthorization of the governor, we believe we'll need to go past the maintenance budget into what we've called the governor's charge or visionary budget. And the total for that would be $4.72 million. So as I said, we came here with an idea. You funded it. These two entities are, in fact, running. But I will tell you from my experience in distance education and also working with video conferencing for a couple of decades, they're still fledgling organizations. They've done well. But I think they will not reach their full potential for another 2 years. And if there is no additional funding, as the governor has recommended, they'll both run out of money before the end of next year. So, again, we thank you for the time, and we are certainly open for questions.
Maggie, my assumption, though, is that the pitch you just made to us is the same pitch you would have made to the governor.
I think Dr. Leach and I will take responsibility for not fully pursuing the discussions with the governor, governor's office. We gave a recommendation, and then the recommendation that we saw from the governor's office is what was made public on the 1st of December.
Well, as a practical matter, for us to fund an executive branch program that the governor's hasn't sunk his teeth into and hasn't committed to it is problematic. So my statement to you is the same as to any other agency. If you think that you did not make a good enough pitch to the governor, if you think that the governor, if having heard the full pitch, would have made a different recommendation, it's really incumbent upon you to go to the governor and say, look, we've got to make this pitch. And if the governor buys it, then he sends up a letter and says, you know, I've changed my mind. And but the vision that you have is a great vision, but visions only work well if the chief executive officer has the same vision. Mm-hmm. And there's no point in funding visions of employees that aren't shared by the chief executive officer. So I guess I hear your, you know, we appreciate what you've done. We don't want to lose the momentum. But that vision has to be a shared vision, otherwise it never works. So I guess the governor is still sorting his issues out. You've got some time before Monday markup. And I guess you, when you're done here, you march down and say, we'd like to have some of your time, and maybe he's got it, maybe he doesn't. But that's kind of the process we got to adhere to. But, I mean, you can understand. You can't. You really can't be funding dreams unless it's a shared dream with the people that are charged with implementing the executive branch functions.
Mr. Chairman, I think Dr. Leach has a comment as well. This task force is faced with a conundrum. One is a reauthorization letter from the governor that is charging us to continue with what we're doing and to expanding it. The second, as you rightly noted, without the funding to do that. I think Dr. Leach probably has some information about a discussion with the governor, because we have not yet had a discussion with the governor.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We can completely hear you. And already have sent in the request, actually, to meet with him. I do want to just, Maggie and I are taking complete responsibility for this. We are new to this game. We are learning, and we appreciate your advice. We believe this is a very important project. We believe that actually this is establishing a model for other collaboratives without creating additional agencies. So we believe this is much more than just looking at distance learning and video conferencing, but perhaps some other major issues that are facing our state and how to streamline processes. So fully appreciate your input, and we are pursuing that with the governor. We do not have any indication that he does not support, but we have not had that conversation, and we will as quickly as possible.
Okay. Strategically, how long will that money that we would appropriate or the governor's recommendation, would that get you to the supplemental time period, or does it change the work that you would be doing in the next 12 months?
I think, Madam Chairman, I think for the Distance Learning Center, we'll probably manage to kind of scrape by until the next year. That's not the case for the video conferencing enterprise, and that is because these two entities have two different, really, I think, operating modes. They're very closely tied together. And those stakeholders from across the state that have provided the vision for this see them closely tied together. The Wyoming Distance Learning Center is heavier with regard to personnel in terms of doing the work and helping agencies and institutions actually develop their own distance learning programs. The Video Conference Enterprise is much heavier with regard to equipment, because while we will avoid duplication by centralizing the equipment for the Video Conference Enterprise, those costs are not going to go away entirely. And so for the Video Conference Enterprise, I will tell you that it will not last until the next legislative session.
Okay, so that would be losing a lot of momentum.
It would be losing almost all of its momentum, yes, Madam Chairman.
And you're right about that. And then can you also tell me if you've spent any time working with our CIO, Flint Waters, and what that picture looks like?
Yes, do you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we have Flint Waters sits on the task force with us. We're talking about how not to duplicate any processes as he's working through his agency as well. And so he's very key on these discussions, gives us great feedback, and is training us as well. But it's a great collaborative conversation between multiple agencies, so it's been very helpful to have all of the key stakeholders on this task force to help make these decisions.
Have you talked to the health department? It looks like you're moving into telehealth and mental health. And the reason I say that is because of the new OCIO organization, there's some federal funds that aren't charged, aren't billed out, some around $4 million, and we're trying to figure out how to get them back into the system. So I don't know if that would be some place where you could go fishing for money or not.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Meyer, in fact, the Wyoming Distance Learning Center is working closely with the telehealth people. And we did, in fact, at the video conferencing enterprise, have the health department people there with us. So we are trying to bring them in there. We will talk with them. Thank you for that suggestion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Murdoch, would you know what the current the balances that are in the book here that say what you have left are based on last August? Do you know what you have currently in your balance? And this would affect page 42, the video conferencing. Both question for both of them.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Von Flattern, if you give me just a minute, okay?
If you follow that, the suggestion is you've spent $1.248 million and you've got about $1.821 left. That's why I read it.
As of last August, they had that. I'm just curious in 5 months or whatever what their balance may be starting out here.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Von Flattern, yes, in fact, we will have a rollover, if that's what your question is, and I may not have your question, have understood your question. The rollover for the Wyoming Distance Learning Center will be about $1,040,000, and for the Video Conference Enterprise will be $321,000. One of the things with regard to the budget differences is simply because the planning for the Wyoming Distance Learning Center and the VCE had planned expenditures. Those were not, in fact, reflected in the university's budget system when that information was transferred over to the state budget office.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a question more directed to you, as my desk mate was doing his math over here, which is always scary in public. Are we to understand that they get to keep the reversion, but they still get the $2 million base budget?
I'm not reading that. If you look over the governor's rec, he's got on 37 and again on 41, they've got profiled $600,000 going. That's the bottom line of the new dollars they get. They're getting zeroed out on 37, page 37. So the way I would read that is if they have unused funds at the end of the biennium of approximately $1.3 million, then they'd get another $600,000 for the between the two, they'd get 1.9. That's what I would read the Gov's rec.
And, Mr. Chairman, I agree with you now that I look at the table. Of course, it's got a zero at the end, so.
Yeah, so the way I read the Gov's recs, you got a couple things. You've got, you'd have available the 600, your reversions of, you will not be called on to revert the 1.3, so you got 1.9 available to you as it sits. What's the longevity? I mean, how long is it going to take you to accomplish your dream that's going to make the world a better place?
Mr. Chairman, everybody comes to you with that, doesn't it, that we're going to make the world a better place, or at least Wyoming a better place, or at least some place in Wyoming is going to be a better place. So, I guess what I would have to say is I can tell you that really, based on my experience and based on what I've seen the Wyoming Distance Learning Center do and the Video Conference Enterprise do in the last basically year and a half that they've been operating, is that it will take them through the next biennium to be fully operational. Will they go away after that? I think the answer is no, because they're providing the kind of service, integration and collaboration that will be needed, continue to be needed across the state. Might they go away sometime? It's possible, but I can't tell you when that might be.
Remind me of this: if you look at when you look at the total resources that we're putting into these types of services for all of our institutions, UW, community colleges, DOE, what's the ballpark of annual or biennial services, what we're actually paying to provide, deliver what's in the pipeline, if you will? That, you understand the question?
Mr. Chairman, if I understand the question, it's what are you already paying for in community colleges, K-12, and the university for distance education? Is that correct?
Right, and Department of Ed.
And video conferencing as well? Yeah. We can get you that number, but I can tell you that it's a little bit difficult to get. And the reason is that, for example, in video conferencing, if you looked at the University of Wyoming Outreach School budget, with which I have a good deal of familiarity, you're going to see people assigned to the Outreach Video Network, but that's not all they do. So, you know, you couldn't count their whole salary in there. I will tell you, for the Outreach School, we only get 25% of our revenue from the state. That's the way the university has always budgeted the outreach school. The rest of the money to support distance education for the University of Wyoming comes from students' tuition and fees. So we can get the number for you. It may be an estimate, but Dr. Leach may know a little bit more about the community colleges and their expenditures.
I guess, well, let me make it easier for you. What I'm trying to do is just to get my sense of it is that when we bark down on this program, we believe that we had not millions, but maybe as much as tens of millions of dollars between backbone services. We don't know where it's underutilized, whether it's overutilized. We've got state agencies, and we have a whole bunch of funding that's uncoordinated. And frankly, I'm surprised. I thought by now we would have at least identified the total dollar commitments in our budgets going towards these like services throughout all of our agencies. Do we even have a ballpark number of what it is?
Mr. Chair, we actually did hire a consultant in the first year to do an assessment and inventory of those items. We found it to be a very difficult measurement to get to. There are multiple items that need to be measured in order to identify this cost, so we don't have that actual cost at this point. Also, because of the reliance on the internet backbone to carry these services, that goes over into another project that's going on currently. The equipment that's in the community colleges, primarily that is sitting in the community colleges itself, are units that are older units that are out of date. So the question is, would you have a savings if you didn't replace them? Absolutely. But the question is that the right thing to do? On the desktop, video conferencing is one of the areas that we know that we need to go to. So the deliverable will be different. We won't be apples to apples. But we have attempted to assess those 400 endpoints and really have had quite a difficult time in doing that. The other piece of this puzzle that I would like to mention very quickly, and that is about the WIN, the Wyoming Equality Network. That is a very that conversation has to be very careful, because when people talk about the WIN, it has two very different functionalities, though completely tied together. One is the video conferencing that occurs on the WIN. The second is the internet connections that the WIN supports. And that internet connection supports every community college, not only instructionally such as distance education, but also administratively and every K-12 system. So to put our hands around what does that entire picture look like and then assess how much it is costing the state is a ominous task that we have not actually been very successful in getting our hands around.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just clarify so we can make sure we get the right information for you, are you asking about the expenditures for video conferencing alone or for video conferencing and distance education?
Let me take a step back in time. Step back in time. We have multiple agencies spending millions of dollars on acquiring broadband, internet capacity. We have multiple agencies that have access to video conferencing over that backbone. We have other agencies who have no access to it. So we've got employees driving around the state to attend meetings because they don't have access, notwithstanding that we've got presumably underutilized backbone services. We had a dream, I think, and the dream was, look, we can stop employees driving around. We can lower our budgets. We can take better utilization of the broadband. We don't know if we need all the broadband that we're paying for. We don't know if there's a redundancy between the community colleges, the UW, and we have these silos. And frankly, if you've already spent through $1.3 million and you haven't even figured out all the silos and all the combinations and what our total resources are and whether there's redundancies or not, that's a little disappointing.
Mr. Chairman, that's why I ask to clarify, to have you clarify, and I appreciate that. We do, in fact, have an inventory of all the video conferencing equipment in the state and all of the endpoints. Centralized already are bridging. So the Wyoming Video Conference System, as part of ITD, really doesn't exist anymore as a result of this. The entities that have video conferencing, and it might be Department of Health, it might be community colleges, it might be the university, those are now all tied together technologically. Any video conferencing equipment requests do come through the task force and then go to the CIO. I can't speak to the broadband. That's a question that I imagine you have explored with the OCIO, Mr. Waters, but with regard to video conferencing, we do, in fact, know where all the equipment is. We know how close all that equipment is to end of life. We know what the costs are for licensing. And so all that is centralized in the video conference enterprise. So I don't have a figure for you right now, but I can tell you that it has been centralized and it will continue, that centralization will continue.
How do you explain or would you explain if you burn through about $1.3 million by my approximate numbers, how did you burn through that money and what did we get for it?
Mr. Chairman, if you're talking about the combined budgets of the Wyoming Distance Learning Center and the Video Conference Enterprise, part of the expenditure, at least in the Distance Learning Center, has been for personnel. And those are the personnel primarily, in addition to the director, instructional designers. And these are people who have the knowledge and the experience to help design distance courses. So one of the things that's starting to happen, and I'll give the Wyoming Law Enforcement Academy as an example. Up until this time, law enforcement officers from across the state have had to travel to Douglas in order to be trained. They're going to start with their first course, and I think it's one of their basic courses. Those law enforcement officers, instead of spending 14 weeks in Douglas, might be spending 3 weeks in Douglas. So we have personnel, and that's part of the expenditure. Part of the expenditure for the video conference enterprise was hiring a program manager to start that technological integration. And part of it also has been we put money into a centralized bridging, a centralized bridge or MCU in conjunction with the WDE. Those are all now under the control of the video conference enterprise. So we have, in fact, gotten classes going for the distance learning, the Wyoming Law Enforcement Academy, for the Wyoming Workforce Services, and I'm sorry I don't have it right in front of me, but there's about three or four state agencies as well as some things in telehealth. So, in fact, there are a number of things going on. Learning management system as well. So the online platform for state agencies is something that license has been now purchased by the Wyoming Distance Learning Center. So each of those state agencies did not have to purchase a license for a distance learning management system. So those are the things that we have burned through, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I guess the as I listen to that explanation, when I think back, and honestly, since I'm not living it, or none of us are living it, we have to refresh our recollections from time to time. But my recollection of the part of the effort and the goal that started under the Freudenthal administration, and I remember the former governor and I have a lot of discussions about how much are we spending for broadband for schools, and are we getting the full utilization of what we're paying for that service? How much are we paying at UW? Are we getting full utilization? And when we started looking at our total budgets that were writing checks every month to third-party entities, is that a broadband capacity that we could better utilize? We had a video conferencing facility sometimes two and three places in a town. But if a state employee wanted to go get there, there's no way to use it because there was either no staff or there's nobody knows how to use it, or you don't even know how to get back onto the backbone. How could we better centralize the services so that, I mean, the dream was is that you could walk down the hallway, flip on a unit anywhere in any building and get access to the broadband coverage, and it would just be there. I mean, we set up legislative meetings. We have hard times often finding places where you can find an operating unit, or when you get there, even knowing how to flip it on, and yet we're paying for a broadband connection there, and there's money essentially pouring through the trough. And the idea was is to say, if we integrated all this, I'm not getting any sense that the parties have sat down to say, look, here's our total resources, here's our total broadband. We can either make better utilization of what we have, or we can begin marrying up our groups. And so I guess my reaction right now is that if we're going to move forward this, somebody's got to reformulate the dream and the objective and make sure that we're all aligned. And that to spend this kind of money on this without a clear dream that everybody in this room, you, the governor, the superintendent, the university, and the community colleges all share, or one that's compelled by legislation, one or the other, it's hard for me to see it. And I'm not denying the benefits that you've just described, for example, to one institution, but that's not the combined product that we were looking for. So I think it is time, my guess is that it's time to revisit this and find out who's the captain of the ship, who's going to direct the ship, and really without the governor being the captain of the ship, you cannot command these different agencies to accomplish what we were looking for. So I think you got, it's a good time to take a look and see. The governor is, I'd say, when I read a footnote like this, says I'll give you 1.9 resources that you're saying is going to take you $4 million, at some point you're saying, why put the resources in and do a half job? But you got to decide what that job is. So I guess right now, maybe my colleagues feel different, but I'm a little bit frustrated that we don't have the same dream, we don't have the same goals, and we're not sure that everybody's participating towards the same end.
Mr. Chairman, to a certain extent, I have to agree with you. I think one of the difficulties, and again, I'll separate the Wyoming Distance Learning Center from the Video Conference Enterprise. One of the things that has not happened and needs to happen is that the Wyoming Distance Learning Center becomes the place of choice. It has to be for state agencies to develop their training in distance formats. That has not been mandated to them. We're hoping that the work of the Distance Learning Center will draw them there. With regard to the Video Conference Enterprise, I think one of the things that's been surprising to me, and Dr. Leach can speak to this as well, is that the stakeholders across the state, and this is state agencies, it includes health, Wyoming Department of Transportation, community colleges, Wyoming Department of Education, all do in fact have a shared vision for the video conference enterprise, and we've done the same thing with the Wyoming Distance Learning Center. If you have not received those visioning documents, we can certainly get them to you. But I think what you said is very accurate. These are still fledgling operations. We will be speaking with the governor. I think you're right with regard to him being the captain of the ship, and having some kind of budget to match the reauthorization charge that he made to the task force. But we're still working on it.
Okay, now here's what I think the practical effects are, is that we're sitting now 2 days, less than a week before markup, we're going to have to make decisions. The governor has got a $50 million problem, and this is a pretty small problem in the totality of what he has to deal with, and you're not the only agency going back to say, look, we need better consideration. So let's assume that you do not have the opportunity to get in and meet and get the kind of face time you need with the governor, and you've got this budget here. What my recommendation is you've got Don Richards available to you, and you need to sit down and create a Section 300 that will essentially authorize the expenditure of the dollars that are there, sort of set out what you want, what you need for cooperation, but ultimately you need to... The Section 300 needs to sort of capture what it is that where we're going, what we're going, who needs to participate, and reformulate this dream, and then maybe provide a trigger that the governor will decide whether to move forward with the funding. So my point is that if we appropriate the dollars would not be triggered or allowed to go out without a reformulation by the captain of the ship of a fund or of a plan that integrates all these hardware, backware, or backbone services, along with developing our distance learning capacity, put it all together and come back with something that we can pass, so we know that before the money's spent, a unified mission statement essentially will have been created, that the governor agrees that he, and that then he pulls the trigger to allow the money to go out. Okay? And I'm guessing the governor's not in a position to say, well, I'll give you another $4 million or another $2 million, so you're going to have to sort out that issue too. But I mean, I use the burn rate, what burn rate you go through, and whether that becomes a 1 year appropriation or a 2 year appropriation, you need to have really a mechanism to know whether or not the governor is saying, okay, you can go through, burn through 1.9 in a year, but we want some deliverables to see whether or not you're going to get there. But, you know, in all honesty, if we're going to spend 1.9 or $4 million, we need a little more result. Further questions? I appreciate having new budget sheets, but they're meaningless unless they've gone through A&I and to the governor. They're absolutely meaningless. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In reading the narrative, though, I'm trying to figure out this task force, and I don't recall the term or I guess the length of this task force, and I guess it was a biennial budget, and so I would assume that it was probably supposed to be a two-year task force, and I don't think they were tasked with the job of fixing it, but to bring back some type of report, take the data, or put together a database of what inventory is out there, what different systems are being used, and then bring back a recommendation. So I guess my question is, when the money runs out in the next 6 months to a year, are we going to have a report that's going to be worth something that we could actually take and use to fix the problem?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Peterson, the consultants that were hired in 2009, actually, were the ones who provided the recommendations for what we would do with distance learning and video conferencing as strategic state assets. From that those recommendations in 2009. The task force made a recommendation to Governor Friedenthal. And the two recommendations were these, that we would create a Wyoming Distance Learning Center, which we have done. The second one was that we would create the video conference enterprise, which would integrate all the video conferencing systems of the state, and that's what we're in the process of doing. So the Distance Learning Center is providing the support and the leadership for distance education, largely the work they've been doing with regard to creating classes has been for state agencies, but they're also leadership for educational institutions across the state. So we have, in fact, gone beyond that idea of a report, and that's the basis on which you granted an appropriation in 2010. So if I've misunderstood your question, I apologize.
No, and Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. I'm just saying I'm sure in reading the narrative of the governor's response and his the same frustration, shares that same frustration, and how long these task forces are meant to continue on. And I'm not a big task force fan, but I appreciate that and the work that you've done so far, and I hope that we're closer to solving the problem that was out there, you know, 2 years ago.
Let me say this, is to just jump in there. I don't know whose original idea it was, but by the time the original appropriation request came to us, it had become a high priority of Governor Friedenthal. And he had a pretty clear vision, at least what he articulated to us, and of where he wanted to go and what he wanted to do. And so that pretty much becomes irrelevant unless the new administration picks up the same vision, the same dream. And if they're not going to crack the whip to get what they want, then all of a sudden the appropriation falls to whatever you folks want to do, and it's lost the plan or the dream or the scheme that the chief executive officer had. And what I'm seeing here is that if you look at the amount of commitment we made in the $2 million, that's a substantial commitment. And you don't do that just because, as much as I love Maggie Murdoch forever, and you wouldn't do that if Dr. Murdoch says, hey, I want 2.3. You only do it when the governor says this is what we want to do. And my sense of it now is I can't tell now whether or not what is the new vision of the new governor? What does he want? What kind of level of commitment does he want to put? What benefit does he see? But he's the only one that can tell all these agencies, you will cooperate. This is what I expect you to do. And if you don't play ball, there will be consequences. You don't have that capacity or resource to compel that kind of action. And this was designed to pull all those resources together. And what I'm seeing now is that you're doing the best you can with those entities who want to play ball with you. And if somebody doesn't want to play ball with you, then they're just not in the sandpile. They're not at the sandbox. And that's fine, but not at this level. It would be some other level of commitment. So, I mean, if you think I'm all, you know, that doesn't make any sense, we ought to revisit, but that's what I see. And having said that, we are running out of time. We did start something that we thought was valuable, and it seems to me that we shouldn't spend any more money on it unless we have a clear vision of where we're going to go, and I don't think the governor, frankly, would have enough time to get there. So what we do is we create a Section 300 that says, here's the resources available, this is our expectation, and if you believe in that dream, pull the trigger and move forward. If you don't, then save the money, and we'll use it for something else. We just give it to you guys to do distance learning, if that's all we're going to get out of it.
Mr. Chair, just one additional comment. Broadband has never been combined in this project. I don't know. It was pulled out. If it was indeed in that first vision, it's not been there since I've been there, and I was there since the second meeting. When you don't talk about broadband, when you don't talk about the infrastructure and the highway that all of this equipment rides on, you are simply talking about those subsets which we have moved forward on. As part of the Section 300, we will pursue with the governor whether or not he has an interest for that broadband conversation to be combined within this topic. It has simply been a separate.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I can only remember the conversations that I had. And when you commit this kind of resources, I don't remember it just being about, hey, we can deliver, we can inventory of all of our equipment, we can provide better distance learning. What I remember is, how much are we spending out on? And it's a ton. And we got different IT guys spending money, we've got different equipment, and we could pull the budget, but I think it's tens of millions. And it's an ongoing cost. And I don't think anybody believes that, you know, when we write a check to Bresnan or to Optimum or to Quest, and we commit to this broadband, are the taxpayers getting the utilization of all that broadband? Or are we just writing a check so that we'll have a certain capacity at 3 o'clock on Wednesday, and the rest of the week all that capacity is lost? So I thought there was a bigger dream. I thought it was there. But if you don't share it, then if that's not your dream, then I think you have to go back and say, okay, here's our dream. It's much smaller. Does it warrant this kind of financial commitment? Okay? Anybody, any comments? Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had some time during this nice discussion that in the packet there is a three-page letter from the governor that he does outline some detail for his goals and objectives. That page 101, Mr. Chairman, and I get a sense, and I don't know who to ask the question to, but from one of you, one of the bullet points, he's giving you 60 days to submit a budget. And am I reading you correctly, a budget to outline his goals and objectives? Am I reading you that perhaps when you come up with a budget, you fall short with the amount of money to accomplish his goals and objectives? Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is true. The charge is beyond what we're able to reach. So thank you.
Well, but having said all that, I have to read the letter. But the governor commands a much more significant budget that's all related to these activities. It's not like if you guys are all alone just with your budget, it wasn't ever intended that this would be the sole budget that would accomplish it. You combine this with all the other resources that are available for these like services. And if you're not getting that kind of assistance, if you're not getting IT folks from around to give you all of their attention, then it's obviously not an important thing.
Mr. Chairman, I will say that with regard to video conferencing, we do have buy-in from all the parts of the state, particularly educational institutions, but also we're making headroads into state agencies. So, for example, we had Wyoming Department of Education and Department of Health at our visioning session for the video conference enterprise. I'd like to reiterate, though, what Dr. Leach said, and apparently what we were charged with originally and what you, the conversations that you had with the former governor may have been different. Broadband was not something that we were charged with, and in fact, at least in our conversations with the OCIO, and again, you'll have your own conversations with him if you haven't already, I know that is something that that is a real priority for him. And these two enterprises will, in fact, benefit from that. So you are exactly correct, Mr. Chairman, that they are tied together. The broadband piece was not one that we were charged with.
Thank you. And I think what's important, and I had a chance through this conversation to just kind of look at your new sheets on your budgeting. And, you know, what's important for us as committee members to realize is that a substantial amount does go to personnel in order to operate this. So, that takes it. And if you don't have that, you don't have staff to run these programs. The other part of it is with the contracts that you have for the management, for example, that's a one-year license. Or is that an ongoing cost, I'm assuming?
Madam Chairman, you're correct with regard to the personnel. That's an ongoing expense because those are the people that are doing the work of these two entities. With regard to the learning management system, and this one happens to be Blackboard, that's a one-year license because we wanted to see what happened with regard to distance learning for state agencies.
So then to follow up, you would be, if it was successful, you would go into negotiations to go more long-term, like a five-year contract or something like that, if we had the whole picture as we developed it out.
Madam Chairman, that is absolutely correct. I know that those of us who have learning management systems, if we go 3 or 4 years out, we get a substantial reduction in that price.
Then the other part that I was interested in is that there was a high cost as far as equipment, especially like in bridging, for example, that you could maybe speak on, and then I had one more point.
Madam Chair, absolutely. The Codium bridges are extremely expensive. This equipment is very expensive. That is the reason why, that is the beauty of the project, in the fact that more people are going to be able to access that bridge with a higher level of technology, higher level of support, and also we're with centralized scheduling, the opportunity that vacant time isn't left vacant, but it is filled by other needs around the state. But it is horribly expensive equipment.
And so here we are, as the state already made a serious investment in this project just based on equipment. And then the third component that I think is important for us to know something about is capturing that cost benefit of agencies that are now not traveling in state or out of state so that they're, you know, there's less time downtime in their proficiency in their work. And until we get more buy-in of the state agencies, but already there should be a benefit from that.
Madam Chairman, you're correct on that as well. One of the things with regard to the Codian bridges is we're moving those bridges into the different technological realm that Dr. Leach mentioned earlier, and that is rather than necessarily having to go to a room, although we will maintain those rooms because we need classes, or you may need rooms where, you know, large numbers of people would meet, we're also moving to desktop, so you wouldn't have to leave your home in order to have a meeting. The second thing with regard to the expenditures. I'm sorry, I lost your last thing. What was your last point?
No, I think that was it. It's the cost benefit.
Oh, yes, and in fact, we are doing that, and the Distance Learning Center is making sure with all of their state agency clients that they are tracking the travel that they aren't having to do, and they're also tracking the learning of their employees so they can tell you whether they are, in fact, learning what they're supposed to be learning in their training.
Madam Chair, just to add another comment, this being a task force, being everything is a pilot, it is very initial. To collect the data on the amount of money saved is very difficult to do. The other piece of the puzzle is developing buy-in. We talked initially about doing it right. If we do not have very stable systems, people will not use video conferencing again for another meeting. In the classroom, if the video conferencing should fail due to the bandwidth, due to the broadband, or for any reason, that faculty member is much less likely to want to ever teach again on video conferencing. It's about changing a culture of getting in our cars, which we all enjoy doing, and learning to pick up our iPads and to hold that meeting within our offices. It's about changing a culture. This charge came down to us in August with the extended charge, and I've now discovered through this process today that we probably didn't fully comprehend the charge of from the previous governor. So we feel like we have great distance that we can continue to move to make this a resource that is statewide, that is beneficial, but we have a ways to go.
If I read the budget on page 39, it says a system needed in developing, as needed in developing collaboration among the various state-supported technology and broadband research and expand efforts to help the state and communities effectively plan and for use of technology resources. When I look at the Governor Mead's letter, it says I want to accomplish, evaluate ways to expand additional services and programs across the state. I mean, you can read that just to be distance learning. I think it's broader than that. Provide recommendations to how to place an enhanced technology base for the delivery of the distance education. That's broadband. Go on, research and recommend new technologies and ways to support effective use of existing new technologies. Look, all of us have been around. You can walk into a corporate office. You can walk on a law firm that's across the street, and they can flip on a switch. They can have a conference with their corporate clients. They can talk to their law offices in Jackson. And we don't have that capacity in state government. And we've got people driving around the state. We've got we're just not where we need to be. But when you say to me, well, we need to do certain things to get buy-in, I don't expect to be in government forever. I'd like to see this stuff moving, and that's why we put money in it, and we'd like to see it accomplished. You don't have to get buy-in. You compel people to do it because we're giving them a lot of money, and we get to the result. And if you can't compel, the only person that can is the chief executive officer. And it seems to me that, I mean, if you look at this letter, it sounds to me like he is committed, but we've got to have a plan of how we're going to get there. And I'm back to the point now that as you go back to prepare what it is that you think the plan is and how we're going to use this money to accomplish a goal, that's what we would like to see in this Section 300. But we need to have, if we're going to put the money in, let's get the resources to do it. Let's make it happen. And I would hope next year you'll know exactly how much we're spending for broadband, how much we're spending for all these things, where are our resources, how can we improve distance delivery, and how can we do it with the resources that we have, because I think we're putting a lot of resources in this through government. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Great. That finishes.
Thank you very much.
Ready? Eli, your sister's watching. Be good. Be nice. You know, it's a, you want to make your pitch now or you want to just wait till later?
Is on. Are you assuming there's a pitch to be made? I guess there's something I don't know about. It's here.
Can we share that?
Sure, it's in the thing. Go ahead.
Yes, my name's Dave Moorbacher. I'm the director of the Enhanced Oil Recovery Institute. Been in Laramie for 2 years now, so this is my first biennium budget presentation to this group. Thank you, Madam and Mr. Chairman, for having us. I'd like to introduce who my friends are. On the end, Bruce Williams, who's the assistant chairman for the commission that we answer to. To my left is Senator Bebout, who you obviously know. And then I'd like to introduce Kathy Olson, who coordinates with our commission and manages our office. So thanks for having us today. The Enhanced Oil Recovery Commission was created in 2004. I'll do a brief overview of what we're about and what we've been doing. We have 20 full-time staff. We use about 20 other staff from the university. I would say we're a fairly unique organization. Our commission is an independent agency within the state. They direct our work. But we're employees of the university. So, and then we work for the operators. So I have three bosses. It makes the job a lot more simple to have three people to answer to instead of just one. But it has gone well. When we talk about exception budgets, we were one of the groups that the university mentioned that we don't have an exception budget for our salary increases because we weren't covered in the university Division One employee count. So when we talk about exceptions, that's the salary adjustments are not included in our budget. So the Institute exists to catalyze development of enhanced and improved oil recovery within the state of Wyoming. We're tasked with benchmarking new technology and then transferring it to Wyoming operators. We have a special focus on smaller operators, although we work with the larger operators as well. We have an outreach mission. Outreach consists of several activities. We have two internal conferences a year. We'll talk a little bit about those conferences in a minute. We participate in several external conferences in other energy-producing states. We have a technical advisory board that we added about 3 years ago that consists of 12 members. And in handout number 161, we have a PowerPoint presentation that that provides a description of the members of the TAB. They consist of major operators in Wyoming. All the folks who are operating the large carbon dioxide floods are on the technical advisory board, as well as representatives from University of Texas, Texas A&M, University of Kansas, New Mexico Tech, and Rice. So we're very fortunate to have that resource available to us. They actively participate in our projects and critique our program twice a year. So with that, I'm going to jump to the cover sheet on handout 161. And talk a little bit about the benefits that the Institute has been able to generate over the last biennium. We've attracted or helped attract new companies to Wyoming. You've read about many of them in the newspapers, especially Denbury. Link Energy is a more recent addition to the state, and last time we talked to them, they've added 200 staff, a good portion of which are located in Casper, Wyoming, to implement their underground coal gasification, and they've acquired Wyoming depleted oil fields as well. The introduction of new operators in the state and working with our existing operators has resulted in substantial investment in our oil industry. I'm going to show some plots of how enhanced oil has impacted Wyoming state oil production once I get through this brief overview. But it's been substantial, and we expect it to continue to grow and be an even bigger, have an even bigger influence in the coming years. We've had one project that's actually booked new reserves. It's an improved oil recovery project working with the local operator. We booked 4 million barrels of oil to that project, and we estimated just the ad valorem and severance taxes generated by that $4 million of production will more than cover the cost of ERI since it's been created. We estimated that at about $32 million with $70 a barrel oil. So we're starting to see oil in the tank or reserves that are booked. And the pipeline's full of projects that we started work on several years ago. The next large project we'll see come down the pipeline will be Grieve. We worked with Elk to characterize Grieve 3-4 years ago. Now, as most of you probably know, Denbury and Grieve have formed a joint venture partnership, and they're investing in infrastructure. We're anticipating that project will result in an estimated someplace around 20 million barrels of additional reserves that'll be produced over the next 20 to 30 years. The operators that we work with range from small one- or two-person oil companies to the big guys, Anadarko and Marathon. Several of the companies we've worked with have made in-kind contributions to our projects. They allow us to use their confidential information for public purposes so that we can show people how they can improve capture of stranded oil in their fields. So we'll be rolling those out in the next months through the next year in workshops and just by working with them on project prospects. The Institute's garnered some substantial contributions for the university, the largest of which is Schlumberger. Schlumberger's contributed Eclipse software that's been valued at over $20 million. We also have just added a new cluster, which is the hardware that runs the software. So we're on the cutting edge as far as hardware and software use for our evaluations of our reservoirs go. As far as outreach and conference attendance, we had 400 people per year participate in our conferences, and we expect that number to continue to grow. So we have folks who come from all over the world to our conferences. I'd say we are the premier CO2 conference in the Rocky Mountains. Earlier in the day, one of our special projects was mentioned. Last May, our commission came to us and asked us to take a look at the Bureau of Land Management's resource management plan for the Bighorn Basin. We did that. We were surprised to see that enhanced oil recovery wasn't really mentioned in the RMP, and so we generated a white paper, and our commission provided it to the BLM as a comment. We estimate that there are an incremental 1.3 to 2.2 billion barrels of oil left to be recovered in the Powder River Basin from depleted oil fields. The Bighorn Basin. The Bighorn Basin's produced about half of the oil that's been produced in Wyoming, and 13 of the 15 largest reservoirs in the state are located there. So we generated a second white paper later in the summer, and I understand from working with the governor's office, talking to the BLM, that the resource management plan was revised so that we could continue to develop those substantial resources in the basin. I'd like to cover just a little bit. We've reallocated some of our costs by refocusing our staff's efforts. We've focused on primarily working with small companies. About 20% of our total resources contributed to evaluating reservoirs with very small oil companies in the state. 30% of our resources are allocated to characterizing and developing the Menalusa reservoirs, and another 30% is focused on developing 10-sleep reservoirs. The reason we have the focus on the Menalusa and the 10-sleep is they've produced more oil and contain more potentially recoverable oil through advanced techniques. in the state. They're the most, they have the most potential for future development. Savings, we've summarized about $100,000 of savings that we developed over the last 2 years based on our $5.8 million budget. We achieved savings through using better software to streamline tasks or simple things like just serving simpler lunches at some of our conferences. But we are sensitive to spending our money wisely, and we've documented those. I can provide a list of all the things that we've decided to save money on, which seems to be a good topic to talk about today. With that, I'd like to go to the plots that are included in handout number 161. There are three of them. The first one looks like this. It's a blue bar graph, and it basically shows enhanced oil recovery production in the state. Production was initiated in 1987 with startup of the Wirtz 10 sleep CO2 flood in Bear Oil. I was there the day that we started putting CO2 into the formation, and I'd worked for 3 years prior to that on the project. So it's nice to see Bear Oil still producing. We've seen a rapid development of enhanced oil recovery since 2004, and that's not a surprise. It's about the time oil prices started increasing, so development is definitely economically driven. The blue bars show increases in tax revenue to the state, and they only estimate ad valorem and severance taxes, not property taxes or property use or royalties. There are other revenues that come to the state as well. The second plot illustrates how much production we're getting from each of the projects. The green at the base reflects the four reservoirs at Bear Oil that have been flooded since 1986. The blue and the purple represent Salt Creek and Monell, and then most recently Beaver Creek Madison has been brought online. And it accounts for about 16% of total oil production in Wyoming at present. The last plot shows historical production since 1981 when oil production peaked in Wyoming. We peaked at about 130 million barrels a year of production. It's declined to about 50 million barrels, or about half of what we produced at peak, less than half of what we produced at peak. The green wedge shows the CO2 EOR production, and the red wedge shows condensate production from the Pinedale-Jonah field. The good news in this plot is production's flattened, and we anticipate that production could climb. Just to put things in perspective, a billion barrels of oil, which is what we talked about in the Bighorn Basin, potential production over 25 years, would boost the state's oil production by 40 million barrels a year. So we could almost double what we're currently producing through an implementation of successful enhanced oil recovery in the Bighorn Basin. And that's just one of many basins that we have to use advanced techniques for oil recovery. So that's my overview. I thought maybe we could move on to the budget and step through our baseline and exception budgets. Mr. Chairman, shall we go forward? Okay, we proposed our baseline budgets. Our budgets are presented in two line items. One is commission and support. The other is task outreach and research. I'm going to take the latter first because it's a larger number. Tech outreach and research covers our technical staff, covers our outreach efforts. We do cooperative work with the university. It covers, it includes monies to support faculty and graduate students who support our work. We've been budgeted at $5.4 million per biennium for the last two biennia. Commission and support totals $449,000. That covers our commission operation. It covers implementation or completion of our technical advisory board meetings. and it provides support for conferences. We recommended exception budgets to the governor, but he didn't recommend them, and we'll operate within our existing budget. There's plenty to do. It's just a matter of keeping focused.
Look at your budget, and I'm just looking at the fiscal profile on page 27. So you've got on the technical outreach and research about $5.4 million. Do you have a percentage of your budget that just gets tied up into the same projects over time so that, in a sense, you're locked into certain programs, or is there a percentage of your budget that's looking for new projects every year?
Actually, the latter is the case. We do look at new projects. We're organized along, we have technical groups, but our projects, for example, in the last 18 months, we've completed 10 projects. We've introduced 8 new projects. So we step through the work. It's not, so there are projects. They're not programs. They have a beginning and they have an end. And we define the objectives with the operators when we initiate them. And we define the operator's contribution to the project, both with regard to staff and other in-kind contributions. So about two-thirds of that is staff. So the staff are consistent, or we try to make it as consistent as it can be. But the projects change. And I'd say a typical project life is something on the order of 6 to 9 months.
Back to your spreadsheet that with your and I look, for example, the circle on university staff. You know, on the left you've got Dr. Towler, and you move across. My assumption, are all those folks paid for by your salary, or are they under the university salary and then doing projects? I've never quite understood how that works.
It's the latter. The latter, Mr. Chairman. They are paid by the university. They teach courses, and we provide funding for them and their graduate students to do tasks on our projects.
While the primary researchers on the top are faculty or anybody that's a professor or but the postdocs, graduate assistants, those folks may be paid through grants through you, but not the the primary professors.
That's the case. Most of what we fund are their graduate students and equipment material costs.
I guess this type. No. So you've got, and so then when we drop down to the next, when you look at these senior research scientists, senior geologists, those folks underneath the research team, would those all be employees of yours, or would they be paid by other sources and you're augmenting them?
Those are our employees.
Okay.
So anything that's listed under the Enhanced Oil Recovery Institute, on the bottom line, the folks that are labeled in blue are our staff.
All right. So, and then when you go off to the project over everything to the right, those would all be on your budget as well?
Everything to the right, we have consultants that we use intermittently,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, and they're brought in for specific purposes and for limited amounts of time. So, for example, Gene George is a pretty well-known geologist from Casper. We have him working on our Menalusa initiative to assist us with describing the reservoirs. I think his cost is probably, at his consulting rates, we probably keep him busy a tenth of his time.
All right. And then, so I guess that takes me back. When you look at your budget then, that's on that page, are all those salaries paid out of the Unit 201 that are on page 27?
All the salary is with the exception of my salary and half of Kathy, the person sitting behind me. We're both paid by the university.
Okay, fair enough. Now, on that, so when you're looking at, say, at your governor's rec of $5.4 million, do you know what percentage is used to support just the salary components of these employees?
It's about two-thirds, $3.8 million a year for our staff. For 2 years. That's for 2 years.
And then the additional one-third then goes to what?
It goes, Mr. Chairman, it goes to a number of things. It pays for training. It pays for equipment. It pays for supplies, software licenses, travel. It pays for field demonstrations. We have about $300,000 a year budgeted for field demonstrations. So it's a smorgasbord of other costs.
The bottom line is that ratio comfortable, and is that what you expect? I mean, can you accomplish your goals with that ratio? And
well, Mr. Chairman, it's worked well the last 18 months. We can't do everything we'd like to do, so we have to prioritize. We develop a strategic plan every year. We update our existing strategic plan every year. We run it by our commission. They provide input. We track our projects so that they know we're utilizing our resources effectively, and we do change directions based on their input and the input of the technical advice report. So the answer is it's working. The ratio seems to be good, and we're accomplishing our goals.
What we, you know, I think there's always concern that you have a research university component that's ongoing, and then sort of a project orientation that is to deliver a product that actually is a little bit different than an ongoing research project. How do you balance those to make sure you're moving forward on deliverables?
Mr. Chairman, it is a balance, and what we've done, there's a pie chart at the very back of the handout, 161, and so what we've done is the left side of that pie chart focuses on small companies and Metalusa, the Metalusa initiative, which is fairly mature. That part of the program generates short-term results that we can see in 2 to 3 years. So if you look at the lifetime of a project, I think that's typical in industry as well. You start characterizing a reservoir, you'll make some suggestions for development, and then measure results. A 2 to 3 year time frame is typical. The projects on the right side, the 10 sleep and our research work, reach out further, and they're still applied research, but they're less immediate. So we expect to see results in, say, 3 to 7 years. A good example of a longer-term project is characterization of residual oil zones in the Bighorn Basin.
Mr. Chairman? Yeah, and to add to that, and I think the way the commission has looked at this and prioritized, and that's why I think that mix and that balance is appropriate, is because it's such a moving target with CO2 in terms of the science in it. And so we're always looking at new ways, new fields, where better ways to do it, including chemical flooding. And that allows us, with the expertise we can get outside and the different programs and projects we can look at, to have that flexibility. And included in that, of course, is the way we're able to help with the Bighorn Basin RMP, which is more or less to take all the advantage of all the information we had and to go to the BLM and say, here's an opportunity to look at the applied science, the scientific side of this, and provide data that by year leaving out essentially CO2 enhanced oil recovery in the Bighorn Basin, you've taken away the right to possibly develop billion barrels of oil in reserves through the ROS and other things. And we could take scientific information to the BLM, and that final preferred alternative plan hasn't come out yet. And Senator Peterson, you're very much aware of that. You were a commissioner years ago and worked on that as well as being a senator from up there. And they've modified their RMP that's going to allow that to proceed now, and so it's been very beneficial. And so that flexibility we have in terms of paid staff that can do the things they do that are full-time versus being able to have to utilize outside people really is a nice balance. And I've looked at that very thing, Mr. Chairman, too, because of sometimes you get overweighted towards the science or the research side of it and the academia. But the whole purpose of this is to provide the tools to industry where we can and how we can to enhance oil recovery through the use of CO2. Bruce, you want to add?
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I would add that one of the things that we have done as a commission, we look at these projects, and we're not very big into esoteric research. We want research that will have real life applicability in the real oil fields in Wyoming, and if that isn't happening, then it's our suggestion to the EOR Institute that they make some changes in what they're doing. And in the 2 years that I've been involved with the Institute, we've seen them be responsive to our recommendations. I think that's the advantage of having a commission that's comprised of non-academic folks directing what's going on in that research.
So the model is then you've got non-academic folks overseeing, directing the research really of grad students with a principal investigator and their grad students. Are there parts of those, each of those projects that are being funded by, augmented by private donations from, and what kind of donations are you commanding on a regular basis?
Most of the donations we've received to date have been in kind. It's very difficult, for example, to acquire core material. So let me just give you an example of a real project. We're working with three operators to evaluate Metalusa reservoirs. One of the operators cut a new core. They evaluated the core. They gave us the results. We brought the core to the university. We have Nor Moro, Mohammed Piri, and Vladimir actually looking at different aspects of the core analysis using the equipment and the know-how that we have at the university. We coordinate that work through Institute staff. We just took the results back. I was in San Antonio yesterday. We presented the results. We've combined it with 3D seismic. We've identified some exploitation programs that they could implement, and I anticipate that we'll probably implement chemical flooding within 2 to 3 years. I think all the work they've done will be paid for with improved oil recovery. But we're using new techniques that improve the way that we can identify how much oil is there and how to get it out, and we're using a combination of both the faculty and our dedicated staff to get it done.
Follow up on that. If you take a typical engineering college model, the university would pay for the faculty member, would be the principal investigator, and he would have his grad students, and oftentimes they would be out looking for private dollars. So those private dollars would really be paying for projects that the industry really wants to see, and the grad students will live and die by the capacity to generate those outside dollars. So as we have this model, you've essentially displaced, you, if you will, the need to get the private dollars by the state filling in, and the I guess a couple questions along that. If that is the comparison of the two models, one is, were there not state dollars paying those grad students, are there no energy companies that are willing to come in and say, hey, we'd pick up that cost because we do at other institutions? And I look at your list of collaborators. Every one of them is a big donor to some engineering college, even on the Front Range, and paying for a lot of grad students to do work. So, and then So the first question is are we simply displacing what they would typically pay? And the second question is the flip side of that, and that is, are we leveraging this money? Whereas, I mean, typically we would leverage it to say, okay, we'll put our money into this research, but we want to leverage that into a matching grant, and that both gets the private buy-in and makes sure that those professors are actually delivering a deliverable that the industry wants.
Mr. Chairman, I can answer the question in two parts because we have a variety of operators that we work with. We haven't done the cooperative work with the large entities that typically contribute to graduate students. I know my education was paid for by Dow Chemical and Phillips Petroleum. We're working with Osborne Ayers. We're working with Merit. We're working with True. We're working with Windsor, and smaller companies are less likely to fund academic research to support their actual field efforts. I've found it to be, in the time I've been here, I've found it to be very effective to ask them to collect extra information they normally wouldn't collect. Something as simple as a bond log, a cement bond log. A lot of the smaller companies don't run the logging suites the majors do, do tracer testing or to help us with by sharing their 3D seismic. We have access to information we normally wouldn't have access to for the smaller reservoirs. Now, when we go to the Bighorn Basin, it's going to be very different. Marathon just joined our technical advisory board. I think what encouraged them to join it is they think we can provide some value to them to characterize natural fracturing, which is really important in the area. They don't have the resources to do it themselves. And I fully expect, we haven't asked yet, but we will, for funding from the majors that we work with in the larger fields. So I divide our world into two parts, and I can say we haven't been completely successful soliciting direct funding from the smaller operators.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. So, Mr. Moorbacher, I know sometimes the university charges for research or charges for doing analysis, and it sounds like you do direct some of that and do the logistics of getting it done. And I don't see anything in your budget that says you have revenue. So if there is revenue involved, further analysis for somebody, is that just the university's money?
Thus far, we haven't charged for any of the analyses that we do. We're concerned about, number one, competing with consultants or laboratories. So we try to do work that's more cutting edge. We're worried about conflicting with Schlumberger's agreement when we do modeling, so we don't want to charge for our labor. I do have a memo that I just provided to all the operators that we work with. We rolled it out first of this year. The first memo is our suggested budget cuts that you requested so they can see what's happening at home. The second memo talks about how they can help us with funding. And I can say that initially it's been well received, but we don't have contracts with commitments yet, but I will. And it's just a lot easier when you have a good value proposition with larger companies who are used to writing checks than with the smaller operators who aren't used to writing checks. Does that answer your question?
Maybe sort of directed towards more to Eli, but the I can't help but since I've had children that have gone to school at other engineering colleges as well as UW, you go on UW, you're really looking at an engineering college that constitutes 1, 2, 3 buildings. You go down to Golden, you'll see a college that probably has 15 or 20 buildings all at engineering. When you're at any of the events in the summer and you're talking to folks from Schlumberger, any of the big companies, most of those companies have pretty substantial research dollars committed to some of those engineering colleges that would dwarf anything that UW does. And I guess as we look back and see where our engineering college is and where its stature is in the community and whether or not those same professors could command this type of research without state dollars comparable to other universities, I guess I don't have a good sense of it, but I assume that we're pretty small potatoes in that total research collection dollars. And part of the question is, as we're looking at where to allocate our resources, is what kind of dollars do we need to make commit towards our engineering facilities? And if we do, do we get a return on this type of research well beyond what we're funding here?
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to answer that. And as I look at, there's really two things going on, and they're sort of different. And you look at the EOR and what we're trying to accomplish with it, and it's not a matter of research. It's more of the applied side of it. And particularly when you look at the small operators, and you typically in Wyoming there's, and I can't give you the percentages, that we have the majors, of course, but most of it is by independents and small operators. And they don't have the in-house expertise to provide the kind of service EOR does. And that's the service that we provide to allow them to enhance their recovery through the use of CO2 or if we're talking about chemical floods. And that's the thing that's better for everybody. And so there's really an incentive for them to come to this board and group to utilize that talent that exists at the university. They do not have it in-house. Do they have the funds to step up and pay for that service? Probably not. So you really get a benefit on the flip side, which is more increased production, which is the case we made to try to show you. When you look at the university and our College of Engineering, of which I'm a graduate, and you compare that like the School of Mines, you go to South Dakota, they have a School of Mines up there, and some of the others, you go to University of Texas, they have a really well-known petroleum engineering college, those kinds of things, and the big donations that come in there for research are totally different than what this is trying to accomplish. If the goal is of the JAC and the university is to look at ways to augment that and try to enhance more research dollars going to the university, then I suggest there's another way to do that. This really isn't in that kind of realm, and it does not provide that service or try to get into that area. This really looks at trying to take known reservoirs that we have, utilize expertise on this staff that we have with good guidance from David to try to enhance that so we can see the benefits in terms of jobs created, opportunities, and ultimately more oil production in our state. So they're really different paths that they're going down, and that's the way that I would look at it, Mr. Chairman. I think you look at the big dollars that the majors send to different universities, and a lot of it is in kind, and a good place to look is the University of Alberta in Calgary, where they've tried to do the applied side more than what we're doing here, and we've looked at that as a way, as a model. And I wasn't around when we formed this and put it together with this model, but if looking at it and comparing it to other ways, I think this model really works for Wyoming and what we're trying to accomplish here, given the nature of the kind of reservoirs we have, the extreme high potential to be able to enhance them with CO2 and chemical flooding.
And let's take your principal investigators. So you have the principal, they're essentially faculty members. Some of them have spent their careers at UW. And the state, by committing these resources, are really saying, look, this is the fork focus. Now, if you didn't have these EORI dollars paying for their grad students, they'd be out looking for, and they'd probably be a lot more diversified in what they're doing. And, I don't know all of them, but I think some of the faculty have been involved in different parts of petroleum engineering, some of them in different types of research projects over the years. Are we losing some of that diversity that exists at the university by essentially saying, look, we want you, the university, to commit to four or five faculty members to push the research towards EORI?
Our budget for faculty is about $500,000 a year, so about 25% of our money, that 20% wedge on our pie chart shows how we allocate our resources, goes to faculty.
As I understand it, some of the faculty helping you run the program, overseeing it, are on university budget. they're off your budget. So they're typically folks paid by the university. The university says, we expect you to teach 25% of the time, we expect you to research 65% of the time, and we expect you to go out and gather X percent of monies to pay for your graduate school programs. So when you command 4 or 5 engineering faculty, you know that essentially you're getting a full commitment of those faculty members to EORI. And my question is, have we lost any diversity or resources going out and expanding the influence of UW in other engineering areas?
Mr. Chairman, if I could try to answer that. One does not exclude the other. We have shown you on the organization chart the faculty and the graduate students that are doing specific work for EORI. They are probably doing some of the other kind of research that they have gone out and hustled money for on behalf of others. I heard this morning sitting in the audience the School of Energy Resources was looking for $10 million of matching funds because they had some commitments from companies that wanted research done on drilling techniques and completion techniques and things that are not enhanced oil recovery, all of which would fall under this petroleum engineering or under the School of Energy Resources. So I don't think one precludes the other. We just are utilizing the faculty as part of the team doing research on specific projects that we've been able to identify that we think have applicability to reservoirs in Wyoming, but we're not in any way, shape, or form stopping them from trying to secure additional dollars for doing whatever kind of research other industry members may want to have them do.
I think in terms of we dropped the petroleum engineering program because we didn't put resources in it, but you could flip it the other way and you could end up having all your resources in an area that really stops development of other engineering areas because that's where you're directing your resources.
Mr. Chairman, I think relative to the overall program, we're just a small part. We fund 5 or 6 faculty and their graduate students. So we fund graduate students for 5 or 6 faculty to the tune of $50,000 to $100,000 a year. That's a very small part of their overall program. It gives us access to all of their equipment that the state's already paid for, or other donors have paid for. It gives us access to their expertise so that when we want to have a relative permeability curve run or we want to see what compatibility of chemical systems are within a core, we don't have to recreate that. So it's a very synergistic relationship, and I think it's really wise to have ERI located at the university. We're focused solely on projects. We don't teach, but we do manage projects. So it's not unusual. I just gave the one project as an example where we're using 3 different faculty to evaluate one core. And so we have the advantage of having access, but in no way are we changing the way that they pursue their own funding and research. I'd say we're a small part of what they're doing. And the benefit we provide in return is we have great access to core and oil, which is really hard to get. You know, Norm Morrow says that's the hard part of academia is getting cores and oil to go with them. So we don't have any problem with that.
Called upon to live on the same amount. Any other questions? Thank you for your presentation, and we'll go to community colleges. Thanks, Eli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thanks for all your service.
What? I just wondered.
collective. Dr. Rose, I guess it's. That's the last time I'll say that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I know we were requested to provide you some additional information with regard to our 600 and 900 series budgets, a history of staffing. I don't know what of that you want us to. I know you've received packets of information from us for a variety of different elements of our budget, but I'm open to your guidance in terms of how you'd like to review
it
again.
You know, I think that as late as we're getting, as much as we need to cover, we might as let's jump right into the meat of it, and that is, and I'll just tell you the same question that I ask everybody. So. You've asked for increases, and we're looking for decreases. And the as I said to the university, it makes almost zero sense to me to say, okay, we'll give you more money that ultimately translates into salary increases and then turn around and ask for an 8%, 4%, and 4% a reduction. And as we move into the markup, it makes more sense to me to say, look, live on what you've had on your standard budget, and then we'll then reassess whether to what extent we need to do any budget cuts, and we may be able to stave those off for a while. So if that is our disposition, and I mean, I guess, Jim, I'd go back to you. I mean, does it make any sense to you to say, hey, here's your increase, and by the way, where's our 8%? Decreases.
Mr. Chairman, I think we do appreciate the situation you're confronted with and are sympathetic to the changing picture in terms of revenue. One thing I would just say as a prelude is the commission and the colleges have endorsed the recommendations from the governor, which again were made in maybe more prosperous times, and there needs to be a reexamination of that. The other thing I would say is, as you are, I know, aware, our budget really consists of two principal parts, and that is one funds an agency, and the other funds seven community colleges. And from my standpoint as an agency director, I can tell you that none of our exception requests for our administrative funds are being applied to any form of salary increase. The exception budgets we're making are for specific either programmatic initiatives or to upgrade outdated systems that we are mandated by statute to operate and support. With respect to the most significant portion of our budget, which is the state aid portion for the community colleges, I can only say that our standard budget is based upon conditions that existed in 2004 and 2005, and that we, by state statute are required to gauge a significant portion of our funding based upon enrollment, and that enrollment in the standard budget is gauged to 2004 and 5. Since 2004 and 5, the colleges collectively have achieved over a 27% increase in enrollment. And as you know, enrollment is a significant factor in the overall operational costs of the colleges. With that said, I'm not in a position to tell you that with how you prefaced your remarks in terms of salaries, that the colleges would not be at liberty to use whatever funds we might receive in terms of any form of our request for exception budget for the enrollment growth. They might choose to use that for salary increases. But what we can say is that the colleges have incurred costs over the last now four biennia that ultimately have resulted in the exception budget request, which the governor did approve and which we believe accurately reflects actual conditions at the colleges. With that said, I think we also understand that having been directed to look at our budgets and propose to you various levels of reductions, and we've done that, and I believe you have, we supplied to you through the budget office and LSO various scenarios of a 2%, a 5%, and an 8% budget cut. So I guess, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I would appreciate the opportunity to sort of distinguish between the commission and the commission as an agency and the request that we are making, which I would simply, in terms of going to that as a priority, is the additional revenue we're requesting for an upgrade to our administrative computing system.
Yeah, we do want to make that distinction. In fact, part of what we've talked about is making sure that our technology is moving forward and a willingness to continue to invest in technology that really is what delivers services to our constituents and moving that forward. But with respect to operating budgets, holding mm-hmm. them firm and trying to reduce the need to for statewide cuts, because as a practical matter, if you take two agencies and you say, okay, you get 3%, you get 8%, now we have to call for 8%, 4 or 8% reductions agency-wide. The agencies that were bold enough to ask for money in this environment get rewarded, and the other ones get penalized because they not only held their budgets, now they're being called upon to reduce them. So as you go through the budget, it is important to us to figure out what technology things you have. Are they going to improve services to the state? Are they important to move our technology forward? And what dollars actually go into an operating budget? And generally, those technology items are one time too. When we get to the community college formula, I do want some reminders with respect to how enrollment growth works. I mean, I know it not only affects the amount you get, but the allocations among the colleges. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of interested to know what I could see a lot of recruiting going on by community colleges, and if is that recruiting effort working? Are those students coming from out of state, so that a college that's able to recruit across state lines from Fort Collins, for example, they bring in out-of-state students, we give them more money, and the allocation then reduces, gives them a greater percentage against their sister organizations that don't have that capacity. I'd like to understand that a little bit, too.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I might suggest is, and we certainly agree, in terms of our agency budget request, we think we've given you profiles of the three different scenarios, 2, 5, and 8%, which as an agency, depending on what level of reductions are deemed to be appropriate, we as an agency think that our priorities, because we have not done across the board reductions. We've selectively chosen places where we think we can afford to, in some cases, completely zero out budgets, as well as reduce more significantly than a 2 or a 5 or an 8% level. And so given that, depending on the final decision about the standard budget, I believe that as an agency we can live with the recommendations of your committee and the ultimate decision of the legislature. I would reserve the discussion of the state aid portion to maybe a bit of a different context. But to go to the first of our exception budget priorities, which, as I said, frankly, Mr. Chairman, is the one that I think is most important to the internal operations of the Community College Commission, and that is exception budget priority number 4, which begins on page 14 of the budget document. And what it delineates is what, first of all, we're dealing with, Mr. Chairman, is a system that's 20 years old, was put in place in 1992, utilizes hardware particularly that is literally held together with duct tape and baling wire. It is a system that is no longer, in some respects, even functional. And because of the support we received from the governor and his recommendation and close coordination with the Office of the CIO, we are proposing a different, entirely different platform, although it's the same software, to operate our administrative computing system, to make it a great deal more flexible and accommodate the new changes in technology so that if and when we come to a point of being able to truly assemble a state longitudinal data system, we have that capacity in place. The CIO also supports our proposal to utilize a cloud-based system as a pilot because of the nature of technology, not any longer seeking to use the data warehouse technology, but to essentially place our data in a cloud environment. And if that works for us, with the coordination and the cooperation and input from the CIO, we will then move that to the colleges. And so that budget request is $3.98 million, and the governor approved that exception budget request.
Let me ask you what it means. I mean, we've talked about this cloud-based system, and with the CIO, a lot of our so-called cloud-based here was centralized data system or data housing facilities in a state facility where the customers are all clouding in, as opposed to leaving that service at an out-of-state firm. What's the model that you folks intend to?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of our own data and the storage of that data, we've migrated a great deal, if not all, and I'm not sure where we are in terms of our total migration, but we are utilizing the state's data storage and backup system here in the Hirschler building. So we're cooperating with the CIO in terms of the migration of where we used to keep our data on our own servers. Now that has been migrated in large part to the state. In terms of the administrative computing system, which is a bit different because it's data that come from the 7 colleges, and by statute we have to administer that system, but as you know, there are special requirements in terms of privacy and confidentiality, and it's a proprietary system. That is going to a different platform, a SQL-type environment that uses a relational database, basically a Microsoft top-type or a relational SQL environment, and that will permit us to be a great deal more flexible with the colleges, and ultimately, rather than even the colleges having to possess servers to store their own data and do their own things, if we move to this entire cloud environment, those servers become unnecessary. And so that's the move that we're making. As I say, we as the agency are making the first step to be monitored and coordinated with the CIO, and if that's successful, we will, and the governor believes that this is something that the state wants to investigate and move into, and so we will be one of the agencies that will essentially pioneer that effort.
To the issue about longitudinal data and the accountability for the education, there's discussion by the accountability committee to move that data collection to the OCIO, and is this something, is this a coordinated effort so that we're all on the same page?
Mr. Chairman, yes. In fact, I've had a number of meetings over the last couple of months with the CIO and the governor's office, the university, other entities, to coordinate this effort. And the commission is fully in support of this consolidation in terms of the way we are moving toward the need to share data. As you probably know, currently there are still silos in place that restrict our access to data that we really do need to be able to share. The colleges now, by the mandate of the reauthorization of the Federal Higher Education Act, are required to report what is called gainful employment data. They have to put out on their websites so the consumers can see it, data that have to do with how students in certificate programs perform in terms of the jobs they secure. And a lot of those data are not immediately available to us. They're in unemployment insurance records or they're somewhere else. And so we vitally need connections to workforce services and to unemployment insurance records and to the Department of Education and all of the entities that we collaborate with. And this new system provides us a great deal more facility and receptivity to moving into that kind of environment, and we're doing it very much in collaboration with the CIO.
Well, for the rest of the members, you're going to see a Section 300 that the co-chairs of the education and the accountability would like us to put through on moving some of this accountability data collection into the OCIO, and there may or may not, I would assume that there's always turf battles, and one of the turf battles is whether that should have resided in Department of Ed or with the OCIO, but this is a great conversation as to why the recommendation is the OCIO. You know, Dr. Rose, I mean, now we got an engineering, I mean, I know that this is an area that you're very comfortable with a high-level IT, so the great question to you is, with your background, are you comfortable with what we're doing to move a lot of this activity into the OCIO, and do you believe that your agency is going to get the service from them that you would if you were commanding it yourself?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to respond. With one caveat, and that is, I have a meeting with Flint Waters next week to discuss a minor piece of language in the enterprise bill that you all will see this session that helps to clarify this one unique issue of the administrative computing system that we have to collaborate with community colleges on. They are already exempted from the enterprise approach, but the commission hasn't been. And so all we want to do is just make clarifying language to understand that that particular system is unique. But with that exception, I wholeheartedly support what the CIO is doing. I think he's assembled a very competent team and has, without question, so far as I have experienced, the technical competence to assemble this in a way that I think is ultimately going to benefit the state. And I don't think we as a commission or any agency has any kind of proprietary ownership of the data we collect. It's not our data. And frankly, if we can begin to consolidate that and use it more efficiently, which I believe the CIO definitely has his eye on the target, and I think the ultimate consequence is going to benefit the state. And so without reservation, Mr. Chairman, we do support that effort, as I say, with that one small little clarifier.
That's that would be one that would be shared by UW. I assume if they have a platform that they're off doing. Is that the type of thing you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, they have already been exempted, as have the colleges, but the commission hasn't been exempted, and we are not asking to be exempted because we want to participate. I mean, as I said, we've already migrated most of our data and our server stuff and all that kind of stuff to the state system. We're not resistant to that. What we do want to make sure we have in place is a clear delineation between our responsibilities operating that single administrative computing system that really serves the colleges and their data needs. And so that's where we just need the clarification, but I don't think it's going to be difficult to do.
At the end of the day, if you've got two different networks or two enterprises, do they share between each other? Does data get moved, the kind of data that we're going to need?
Mr. Chairman, the data that we're talking about are pretty exclusive data in terms of the administrative computing system. It's most all of it student data, so it's FERPA protected. We have to, by law, report it to the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System and a multitude of other entities in order to conform to Title IV requirements and all of that. So that's a very specific kind of data. Then the other stuff we collect that really we, as I say, we don't necessarily need to have that in our own shop. Those are all data that we can certainly warehouse or store or perhaps placed on the state servers. So I think there's already a pretty clear dividing line between the very unique data that are college data versus everything else we do that we really are not asking to be taken out of that proposal to create this new enterprise agency.
The request for the computerization. Next item, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if, given your initial comments about our exception budgets and where we should go, and in light of the time, if you have specific, I mean, I would certainly go through every single exception budget request.
To speed things up, we want to spend some time on the direct aid, and the next one is once again computer 27,000. We could see that, so that's about all the mention you need to do, and then we just move.
Mr. Chairman, that's a budget request for our agency to basically do hardware replacement. The one qualification I would have, and I have a handout that I can pass to you that you can use for during markup. There was a significant departure from what the OCIO recommended and what the budget office recommended. We had a budget request that the governor initially approved of about $57,000. The CIO cut it to about $55,000. Then the budget office cut it to $27,000. And I think one of the things that needs to be clear is that most of the cuts were done for training and the kinds of things that we still feel are essential for us to conduct. And what we would request is we have some flexibility because, for example, one of the elements that was approved in our budget by the budget office was a $7,900 request for teleconferencing equipment that, frankly, I could do without. And I would rather have some of the training manuals and some of the things that we need for our staff development. So some of this, if we can move some things around, we understand the need to reduce budgets, but there was a significant departure between the OCIO's recommendation and the budget office. And so the handout that they're providing you will give you some background on that, and I don't think I need to say any more.
I mean, okay. When we see the handout, is it going to essentially say, look, if we're allowed this amount of hardware upgrade, this is where we would apply it as opposed to where the governor recommends?
Now, Mr. Chairman, what the spreadsheet will show you is that there are some purchases of basically one-time equipment that have been approved and then some other things that are of a training nature that are a different sort of category of funds, and those are the ones that were denied. So, but as I said, if you all have this spreadsheet now, I can just I can just point out to you one line item, the video conferencing unit at $7,900 is one that, even though it was approved, that's not necessarily one that we see as important as some of the ones that were not approved. And and we weren't made aware of the recommendation, the final $2,734 recommendation, until it was too late to do any negotiating. So
take a look at that now. Okay. As we're moving through these denials, we need for you to give us a little bit of background on it. And simply because, I mean, I assume that there's, particularly for things like the Even Start program, that's a program that has employees being paid. It's got a constituency. I would expect that if we agree with the governor's rec, that there will be a constituency moving to restore those funds. So we just need to know a little bit about what the status of the program, what's it doing, what's the impact of cutting, that sort of thing, so that we can be able to respond.
Mr. Chairman, we can go to that one right now. It's on page 24. And frankly, what we would propose to do is part of the funding for the Wyoming Family Literacy Program, it was called Even Start, but as you know, as of July of this year, federal funds evaporated. So it's no longer funded at all by the federal government. So we have complete ownership of this, and we operate four programs. And we would continue to operate those four programs, albeit with some reduced, because that's already in our standard budget. What this $1.7 million requests is to expand that program because we know how successful it is. And I don't want to belabor it. I know these are issues that you'll have to work through. But the one thing I would say is this is dealing with a population that is not necessarily duplicated by things like Head Start. Head Start, in fact, refers some of their clients to these programs. I just leave you with the fact that In May, when all of the Wyoming high schools graduate their students, for every one of those students who graduate, we will have, in this state, seven people 16 years and older with no high school credential. Over 40,000 people are unemployed and underemployed because they don't possess any form of education, even to what is commensurate with the high school level. This program is designed to try to attack some of that problem, and so that's the reason we've put it forward as an additional funding. It funds additional programs where in communities that are not currently being served.
Mr. Chairman, this program does, although the governor's recommendation mentions a couple other programs, this program does a lot that is different. It's really a holistic view of the family. And so I realize we're probably not going to be growing any new programs here this year, but it would have my unequivocal support for it, and I hope that we at least maintain what we're doing, and in maybe 2 years we look at this again. It's a great program.
Mr. Chairman, I think now it may be appropriate, and particularly given the fact that you probably are – you're all going to get a little surly, even more surly, as you get closer to the dinner hour. So, Mr. Chairman, the spreadsheet simply is by object code what we in detail gave to the governor, and that was reviewed by the CIO and by the budget division in terms of our request for very specific items and their relative costs, both showing the budget office's recommendation and the CIO's recommendations in the third of the last and the second of the last column.
Okay,
and then the final governor's recommendation.
I was halfway expecting for you to have one more column using the same dollar amount approved by the governor's rec, but reorganized in the way that you'd want to see it done.
And Mr. Chairman, we would be happy to do that. We weren't given time or opportunity. So.
Well, why don't you? I mean, you've got a day and a half now.
Okay. Okay. Well, we can certainly do that.
Why don't? I mean, if you said, look, given if we're allotted $27,000 for computer upgrades and maintenance, how would we allocate it? So you'd give us one more column on maybe just narrow things mm-hmm. down and give us another column and show how you'd have it reallocated if it was your wants.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to do
okay,
that.
Okay, and you, like I say, you got a whole day and a half.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
Unless there are other questions about our administrative budget, I think it may be appropriate to move to the standard state aid budget. And as you can see, that's a general fund appropriation of $188,554,591. And that really, again, is predicated on what is currently in our standard budget. And so where we, by statute, achieve any kind of adjustment to the change of conditions at the colleges is through our exception budget, which I think begins on it begins on page 28. What I would simply indicate to you, Mr. Chairman, is our request was for a given amount, $22 million. Adjustments were made, legitimate adjustments, because of the nature of the way funds were actually appropriated during the last session. And so we feel that the budget request of $14 million really does reflect, in fact, accurately actual enrollment growth. We can document that we have this many students. And so that, we think, is a very legitimate cost of operation to the colleges. We understand why the governor denied the request for an additional $3.3 million or $3,294,000 because those, in fact, are not of the same nature. We can come back to you in the supplemental budget if we actually achieve that enrollment. And so we understand that denial, and we don't disagree with it. But the exception budget for enrollment growth is one that the colleges have already incurred the costs, may have spent down the reserves to cover those costs. They've hired additional faculty. They've taken on the additional expense of that growth in students. And as I said, it's right at 28% from 2004 and 5. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be open to your question.
Forward to the priority number 10, I think, which is the...
It's actually priority number 1, Mr. Chairman,
okay.
On page 28.
All right. Which was the denial?
No, the governor actually approved it.
I got you. All right, let's talk about that. So, I mean, if at your state aid at $188 million, if you're called upon to do a 4% cut, that would be how much?
Mr. Chairman, you asked us for 2, 5, and 8, and so I guess I could take our 8% and cut it in half.
Give us the 2, 5, and 8s. How's that?
Mr. Chairman, the 2% cut... the 2% cut to the $188 million amounts to $3,365,692. The 5% reduction, and I believe we distributed this. I think you should have under the IBARS kind of format these columns with the 2, 5, and 8%. And, Mr. Chairman, I think I may be anticipating your question. If you go to an 8% cut, you see that it's about $14 million, which is the level of our exception budget. So,
the flip side of that is it's an 8% increase in your budget, then.
Mr. Chairman, the exception budget would be, in fact, yes, and it would be a one-time increase because of what the statute says, is we are required every biennium to come back to you and request funding for enrollment that's occurred since the base period, which is 2004-05. So we would receive this $14 million in funding only for this biennium and then have to come back and make a case for wherever we are with enrollment for the 2015-16 biennium.
Do we have a spreadsheet that shows how it allocated funds to institutions and
We do.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe I've brought copies for the JAC, but we certainly do have that that would show the allocation of that $14 million across the seven colleges.
We can provide that, Mr. Chairman.
You know, and I know you, let's, if you will, talk a little bit about how the formula works to generate this 8% increase.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the funding formula is basically a bifurcated or a two-sided formula. One part of it is derived from what we consider to be fixed costs, those costs of the institutions that don't vary with how much enrollment there is. They're costs that are dependent upon operation of physical plant, of the given built-in costs of just keeping the doors open, supportive outreach sites, a multitude of different things. The other side of the model is based and driven by the amount of credit that each college generates. So we collect data on enrollment, and those data are used to determine credits that the colleges deliver at three different levels. One is level one, which is the standard classroom delivery. Level two is a little more technology and more restrictions in terms of the number of students in a class. And level three is high technology, a lot of equipment, and restrictions in terms of class size. And those establish then the other side of the funding formula in terms of what portion of total state aid will be distributed based upon fixed costs, which is about half, and variable costs, which is about half. And so that's the basis upon which then, and we calculate a cost per credit that the state supplies, and we apply that to the credits that have increased, and so that gives us this amount, this $14 million. The governor, and we respect his decision to take out the ECAR. One of the other reasons that was a $22 million request is we had an external cost adjustment in there, and that came out. But bottom line, that $14 million that we are requesting reflects the cost per credit times the number of additional credits that have been delivered over these past biennia.
I'm reminded a little bit about, and I don't know if it is applicable, but if you position payments, so they went, at one time went out and calculated that a radiologist ought to, in order to make a living, is going to do an approximate so many number of procedures, and if you give him a cost per procedure, he's going to make a living of X. And then along comes tort reform and other things, and now he's doing 10 times those procedures and making 10 times as much. How does this formula avoid that? If every unit cost that you provide is the same reimbursement to you, then obviously you're driven to provide as many credits as you can, and the more credits you get, the more you get reimbursed, notwithstanding you may be providing it for the same number of professors.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, and that's one of the conditions of a block grant. Is that's totally in the province of the seven elected trustees of a given institution. The one thing I will say that will somewhat change the overall distribution of whatever appropriation we receive this term. For beginning in July of 2012, this year, we are required by our strategic plan, which is gauged back to state law, to take 10% of the variable costs that we distribute to the colleges and hold that back and distribute 10% of those variable costs based upon completion. The challenge that colleges have had over time has been that we focus so heavily on access that we haven't done as good a job, although our colleges are far above the national average in terms of the way we complete students, but we don't complete students quickly enough. And so the cost of the state that's bearing a significant portion of the cost of attendance for students to support them in their education is in some cases the effectiveness of that support is diminished by the fact that if a student doesn't graduate in a reasonable time, then it's costly to the student in terms of loans they may take out, but it's also costly to the state. Because as you know, this standard budget represents about 60% of the college's operating costs. Only about 20% is supported by the student's tuition and fees. And so we feel that if completion becomes a component and there is some attention given to completion, then there will be some an additional element of performance introduced to the model that is not currently there. Because what we do is at 12% through the semester, once 12% of the semester has gone by, we take a census. And all the students that are in the class at 12% are credits that we pay for, no matter what happens up until the end of the semester. This system, by taking into account completion, starts to give some attention to that, what we consider to be that problem.
A couple of concerns. One is, of course, you have the issue of can we even afford it even if we wanted to do it? Or should we? And then essentially ask for budget cuts back. The other issue that I'm interested in is listening to this is we continue to provide select committees and task force to go to the community college and come up with these magical formulas that tell us what we should be reimbursing you for. Those formulas have never achieved what I'd call wide consensus in the legislature as, gee, that's great. I have no doubt that if we went to the University of Wyoming, for example, and said to them, why don't you figure out a cost per credit produced, and we'll reimburse you on that, disregarding what your costs are, they'd be coming in with a 10 and 20% increase every year and said, well, hey, formula says did this many classes, and now we're producing these credit hours. You owe us. Here's the check. And the notion that, hey, we got a formula, and it calculates this, and here's the check, I don't think anybody's gotten there.
Right. That's right.
So we have a two-part discussion. Maybe I don't know that we want to avoid having that other discussion, and that is, it really means very little to me that you're teaching more classes. I want to know, have your variable costs actually gone up?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested to know how they went up. If you recruit kids from overseas, from Colorado and around, and increase your enrollment, I'm not sure that the state of Wyoming is interested in paying a lot more for that. We want to have those students, but are we prepared to pay an incremental cost for them? I guess, turn it back to you.
Mr. Chairman, one thing we are required to do by statute is to recalibrate our model at a minimum of every 4 years. So we are, and I know that's not meant as a pejorative, but I know some of the difficulties that you've seen, not just with community college funding, but in terms of funding education in general. Arriving at any kind of defensible, accurate, cost-based system is extremely difficult and is so variable. Once you have something pinned down, then conditions change and you no longer have a valid set of data. So we are sympathetic to it, and we have the charge to periodically review how the model is functioning. And so that's something we have to do anyway. There may need to be refinements. We still feel that this model, by virtue of its predictability and its simplicity, is a far cry from where we were when we were using a comparator-based model with statistical manipulations and predictor variables and Cook's D theory and a multitude of statistical hocus-pocus. So we think this is more transparent. We believe, and as you said, Mr. Chairman, there may not be universal or even partial endorsement or acclaim for it, but we think it's something we can utilize and refine and go forward with, and I think it does give a fair distribution of the resources that the state allocates to the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rose, refresh my memory on the history. Your narrative says you've had growth every year since the base model was put together. So there's been a request every budget cycle. What have we done? Have we given you the extra money every time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stewart, we have, as you are correct, we have proposed exception budgets to address the enrollment growth component as we are directed to do by statute. And in some cases, those appropriations have been made. In some cases, they've been reduced. We made a request for $6.8 million to reflect recent enrollment growth, and that budget was reduced by half, but then was biennialized, so it became a $6.8 million effective standard budget appropriation. So there have been some changes over time, but you're absolutely correct in that we are coming to you every year in terms of saying, here's where we are with enrollment. The one piece I would offer as additional unsolicited information is that we are now in a period where college enrollments are flattening out. And so the days of double-digit enrollment growth are we're not seeing that any longer. And this model is designed precisely because of the nature of the exception budgets, one-time requests rather than introducing those additional funds into the standard budget. We regauge back to a base period. And so if our enrollments flatten or decline, you're going to see smaller requests.
Follow up. And again, I don't know if this is accurate, but did we use ARRA funds for this request last year, Mr. Rose?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stewart, $8.3 million of state fiscal stabilization funds were allocated to our enrollment growth. Another $17 million was allocated to major maintenance. So we received overall about $25 million of stimulus funds. $8.3 million of that was to address this very issue. Yes.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rose, as I'm trying to get an idea of the increase in this, you said 28% since 2004-2005, and I'm just trying to, I'm guessing that probably the Hathaway had more of an effect on community college growth than it did on a university, because it just has that student. I'm thinking of the student that college was questionable. Now the Hathaway is available, so he goes to his community college rather than the university. So I'm guessing, and if you can answer that. And then the second part is, when we consider out-of-state students coming to community colleges, we've heard the university trying to keep tuition down and attract out-of-state students. Again, I would think as community colleges be a better deal for this type of student, lower income, that it probably has a larger effect on our community colleges close to that, those out-of-state, you know, or those state boundaries. So those two things, out-of-state and in-state and Hathaway and lower tuition costs.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, I would, first of all, with your permission, rely upon the presidents, because I think they're a great deal closer to how enrollment may have been impacted at their own institutions by Hathaway. But what I know in looking at the data suggests to me that it hasn't been as robust for the community colleges as it has been for the university. But they would have to give you their own anecdotal information. With respect to our position in terms of attracting students from, and of course, as you know, we're part of the Western Undergraduate Exchange, so we give the same kind of break to students participating in that from the 15 WUI states, just as the university does. So they pay 150% of in-state tuition rather than out-of-state tuition. But one thing we have done with our tuition policy, we have tried to keep abreast of where we are tracking in terms of tuition versus our comparator, 15 comparator states. We take out California because California has no tuition, and we add Nebraska. But those 15 comparator states, we then try to stay somewhat below but in sync with them, and we are losing ground. Those states are moving up at a much steeper slope than we are in terms of the cost of tuition. And so the commission did institute a $4 increase in tuition this past December to try to keep us at least not completely out of the zone of being comparable. But I think one of the things you can see is that, and as I say, some of the particularly the institutions, for example, in your area, I think Northwest College may attract a significant number of students because of the relative low cost. And LCCC here in Cheyenne has the same advantage. Some of the other colleges more in the central part of the state may not have quite that same advantage. And our enrollment report documents where students come from and the numbers of in-county versus out-of-county and in-state, out-of-state, out-of-country. A lot of that data, there are a lot of data available, but individually it may vary by institution, and if you'd like more information, you could certainly ask any or all of the colleges represented.
Well, thank you. And then, Mr. Chairman, if I may, probably another indicator is probably the economy. It's been hard on families, and especially here in Wyoming, lower median income than some of our surrounding states, and so I'm sure that has an effect on this 28% growth. I was just trying to get an idea of the 28% growth. I don't remember what the growth was at the University of Wyoming. It's a little, but not 28%. So it's impressive. I was just trying to get an idea of the reasons why. But.
Mr. Chairman and Co-Chair Berger, we believe, and this is pretty true as a phenomenon across the country, that community colleges enrollments are pretty counter-cyclical to the economy, so that when the economy does decline, because people either are threatened in terms of their jobs and they feel they need to upgrade their skills, or they may be out of a job, or there's a multitude of reasons, but when the economy goes down, enrollments go up. But there is a leveling off point where you basically have people that are chronically unemployed and they're given up. Or you really address that audience, that constituency that really wants to benefit and has gotten on board, and then there's a sort of flattening of that, of the available and number of people and the interest that's there. So I think part of what we're seeing is not necessarily that the Wyoming economy now is improving so drastically that there aren't any interested people any longer. The flattening of that, I think, may also be a phenomenon of just simply we've received the folks who were affected most directly immediately by the economy, and now there's less of that effect to be seen.
Other questions? Should I continue? Okay. Continue, Mr. Roof.
Well, Madam Chairman, we can walk through a whole bunch of these exception budget requests, and frankly, I'm not sure what your pleasure is. It's nearly 6 o'clock, and we understand. I guess one thing I would try to reiterate is we are very appreciative of the governor's support for this budget. And I don't want to belabor by causing you to have to stay longer than you really are interested in to go through every single one of these exception budgets. But I'm certainly willing to do that at your...
You're going to come back in the morning.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Thank you for the invitation. Oh, we'll even bring donuts. Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, did I hear you say what else do we have on Monday? We have that the CIO's presentation for the agency 306 reorg. Hey, we're going to come back.
Get them that distribution stuff.